Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing compassionate care and cancer specialists who are experienced in the cancer you have. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. New research published by the American Psychological Association is putting a fine point on how screen time affects teenagers' sense of self-worth negatively. We'll open lines up to all you parents out there. How long can you keep a kid from the influence of the influencers? Are our kids spending too much time on screens? What to do about it?
I'm Marjorie Egan. In the weeks following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we were joined by two local Ukrainian-Americans. We'll check back in with Sevalod Petriev and Tetiana Litus 1 year into the war on how they're keeping hope alive after a rally yesterday on Copley Square. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie.
How are you?
I'm good.
That's good.
And I will say that we're at the library not just tomorrow and not just Friday, our usual days. We're there Thursday. Do you know why we're there Thursday?
Because we're going to be interviewing Governor Moore Healey.
Yes, Ask the Governor is Thursday at the Boston Public Library. We hope you'll join us. So new research published by the American Psychological Association is putting a fine point on how social media use affects teenagers' sense of self-worth. Study found that when teenagers cut down social media use to roughly an hour a day, they saw noticeable improvements in how they felt about themselves. But getting there is not going to be easy. Get this number. It is staggering. The average U.S. teen spends 8 hours a day looking at their phones. 8 hours. How much?
You think that's too much?
Well, in light of the fact, how many hours are they awake? 12? I mean, you know, we want to give you parents out there a chance to weigh in. Have you found a way to rein in screen time with your teenager, or do you consider it such a lost cause you don't even try? Or if you're a Gen Zer yourself, is all of this just another instance of back-in-my-day boomerism? Set us straight at 877-301-8970. That's for texting or for a calling. 8 hours a day, the average teen spends on their phone. 8 hours a day, Marjorie.
Well, you know what's a big thing, too, and I'd love to hear what parents say about this, because thank God when my kids were young, we didn't have to deal with this issue. What do you do about the kids taking the phone in the room at night? You know, especially teenagers, are they allowed to keep their phone with them in the bedroom at night so they can be texting and on social media all night long until like 1 o'clock in the morning? Or these studies all say that's a terrible idea, even for older teenagers. They should be out of there.
You told me you went to a performance last night and you said they made you put your phone in a pouch and leave it at the entrance. So how about when your kid is about to walk into his or her bedroom at night, the parent stands there blocking the door with a locked pouch and says, insert phone insane. What do you think?
Well, they've got a story here from the St. Andrews school, this Episcopal boarding school is far away. It's in Middletown, Delaware. But that's exactly what they do. They have the kids put the phones in a place in some locker overnight so they can't have them in their rooms.
Dartmouth High School right here in Massachusetts doesn't allow phones with their students.
So we have a whole list of phone of schools that are trying to get rid of phone use during the day. Springfield Central High School, they have to shut down their phones and put them in magnetic pouches. Only teachers and administrators can open at the end of the day. Chicopee High School has a cell phone lockup as well. Boston, of course, you know, school by school is a decision there, but it seems so obvious that kids shouldn't have them during the day, and it seems so obvious that kids shouldn't have them in their beds at night. But I think a lot of people I know, just anecdotally, their kids give them such a hard time about it. You know, they can't keep up with their buddies if they're not texting until midnight.
Well, yeah, I have to say the only thing I'm fine with schools banning it, but the other side you have to think about, it's really, those are the prime sexting hours from what I understand. And that, so there are a bunch of issues if you're not convinced. Every expert with whom, well, not only we've spoken, but we've read, says they're addictive. Secondly, they say that they inhibit relationships and the real world. And I love this term. I mean, the concept you've all heard before. The American Psychological Association, that survey I mentioned a minute ago, refers to something called the comparison trap.
Yeah.
Being on social media, being on your phone, puts you in a position where you're comparing yourself to somebody else, knowingly or unknowingly, which is what gives you a damaged sense of self-worth. So the theory is, these are the solutions. Limit your kid, if you can, I don't know if it's doable, to an hour a day. Have a day off, they say, once a week. Say Thursdays, you can't do the phone at all. And this may be the most difficult, is if you can convince your kid that he or she should not be on the phone more than 1 hour a day. You should replace the typical phone hours with a fun, real world experiences, which again may be difficult. 877-301-8970 is the number. Where do you want to go?
You know, I can totally see where comparing yourself would drive you absolutely insane, because of course they can rig these photographs. Everybody looks better. They look, thinner. They look blonder. Whatever you want to look.
Yeah, but
like,
that's with people you don't know. This also happens with people you do know.
It happens with people. Well, it does happen with people. You can doctor these photos from the kids across the street. You know, so instead of obsessing over what you want, what a model looks like, you're confused about what somebody down the street looks like.
Now, Brian Bell has an interesting thought. Brian, who is essentially making the show work here, says his Infinity account offers a service that allows him to control what apps his kids can use and at what time. He has 10 to 6 quiet time, Marjorie, where texting, TikTok, and Instagram are silenced through that app. The thing that Brian obviously missed is each of his kids have burner phones, and they do that. So that's part of the problem. 877-301-8970. By the way, anybody who does not understand this is a problem is like literally has their head in the sand. The problem is, how do you convince your kid not to do it? And other than taking the phone, which I think is not what you should be doing because it shows a lack of trust. Other than taking your phone, what kid is going to adhere to rules in the house about phone usage? None.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what remember the line? Well, everybody else is doing it. And then you're supposed to say, well, if everybody else was jumping off a bridge, would you jump off the bridge? But the thing is, that is the argument that teenagers give now, is that all their other friends have their phones in their room. They're on Instagram. They're on TikTok. They're on all these things, and they're texting. So if they're not part of that group, then they become an outcast in their group. That is their story, and they're sticking to it.
By the way, feel free, in addition to you calling about your kids, feel free to call about yourself. I would argue that most of us spend too much time on our phones. Would you not agree with that?
Yeah, you're not supposed to read from your computer or your phone or your iPad in bed, but I think a lot of us do that too.
Let's go to Amanda in Mansfield. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. How are you today?
We're good. Thank you for calling.
Good. I just wanted to share, I have a tween. He's 12, and you know, everybody has phones. He has an iWatch, and it has been kind of remarkable because he can still text and participate in group texts and things, but he can't sort of just like surf the web on there or like, you know, do all the different apps. But it still, I think, fulfills, you know, the social aspect of getting to still connect or be in group chats or to, you know, be able to text your friends or call them or have a phone number. I also can control it from my phone. So, for example, he's at school right now. I can turn on school time so that he's not, you know, going to get in trouble and be on the phone at school. And I can adjust those hours to be whatever.
How does he feel, Amanda, how does he feel if you do it unilaterally from afar?
You know what? He has not complained.
That's great.
He feels cool that he has one. You know, this is a Christmas gift. It was a big gift. So I think he's appreciative, and he's still like I said, he still gets the birthday. He's not 16 yet, you know, but he is excited to have it.
Amanda, what is your school, your kids' school's policy about phones in the school?
Well, that's one of the things I love about the having the watch, is they're not supposed to have it. And I am sort of, you know, sometimes I do worry. So I can unlock it and text if I need to without him getting in trouble. But yeah, they're supposed to keep their phones in their backpacks or lockers until the end of the day. And they do all get right on them, you know, if any of them are like at school for sports or anything like that.
Yeah. Amanda, thanks. That was great. Congratulations.
You have seen the pictures.
The success,
you have
like.
Seen the pictures from the back of the classroom, right, where the kids have got
their
Google Chrome in front of them, you know, or their whatever you call those things that they hand out to the kids. And what do they have in front of that? Their phone, so the teacher from the front of the room can't see it, but if in the back of the room, you can see it. Or they get it between their legs. Right?
You know, whatever. And have it on vibrate. Is that what you're going to say next?
I was not going to say that.
Now, let me say this. Amanda reminded me of a story that is one of my favorites to tell about a coworker of ours whose name shall be not given. Uh-huh. Is she mentioned that she has the ability from afar to sort of track usage or whatever it is. A friend of ours, when her son passed the driving test and began driving, was very concerned about his safety, so she put a tracker on his phone. And she actually told him there was a tracker.
So
she texts her son just as he's learning to drive, and the first day he drove to school, so what are you doing? Are you driving? What are you doing right now? And her son said something like, well, I'm at school, I'm studying, or something. So she turned on the tracker. He was at Capitol Grill in Burlington having lunch.
Yeah, and another time,
that's pretty
didn't he drive to Maine?
I don't know, but it's really pretty. And yeah, the amazing part is he knew, at least she had told him, that she was doing the tracking, but it had no impact. 877-301-8970.
They talk about in this big study from the CDC. I mean, it's just overwhelming the impact on. I mean, people say this every generation. Oh, radio's. I mean, a million years ago, radio's going to ruin everything. TV's going to ruin everything. Computer's going to ruin everything. But the change in the last 15 years from smartphones has been massive. And those of us who have attributed it, as I sometimes have, to COVID or Donald Trump or climate change or mass shootings or all these things, apparently are wrong, because the deterioration. This is from Michelle Goldberg, column in the New York Times. The deterioration of teenage mental health predates COVID, and it predates Trump, and it predates a lot of the real dramatic climate change concerns, which I think have been more recent. So it much more correlates to the introduction of smartphones.
Well,
doubt about it, right?
Isn't it obvious that if your relationships are through your phone, that you are not prepared to enter the next phase of your life with an actual human being? Is that not obvious? Yes.
Well, I think the thing about the phone is that it's with you 24/7. And we talked about this years ago with some remember the little girl Phoebe Prince? She was 14 years old.
Of course, she killed
committed
herself.
Suicide. And
South Hadley, Massachusetts.
Right. This was I believe about 12 or so years
ago. Cyberbullying, big time.
Cyberbullying. And one of the points that was made then, which of course was after the introduction of smartphones, is that you might have been ridiculed at school or bullied at school or had a really tough time in school.
That's a really
when you get
point.
Home, you are in your little safety cocoon,
really
assuming you
point.
Didn't have lunatic parents, that you had a good household, you were home safe there, but that you no longer have that safety cocoon because electronics
can be reached all the time.
Can infiltrate it.
Donna in Arlington, hi.
Hi, guys. Love the show. Great
Thanks.
Topic.
Thank
Great
you.
Great topic.
You.
Could go on for hours. So I have an older teen and a younger teen, and I did it differently with each of them, and I feel like I learned from my older one. The older one, I was trying to control it more, so I wouldn't let him have the phone in his bedroom at night or a certain time, because I felt, you have no impulse control. You're an adolescent. Of course you're going to be on this thing. And I think where that showed me I did it wrong was I didn't actually teach him how to turn it off himself. And with my younger one, what I do is I say, okay, you want your phone, because she also has an iPad, right? You can go
right.
on
yeah.
Snap
yep.
an iPad. You can do all that. But she uses the iPad with the Calm app to help her go to sleep. So I'm like, okay, how do I win this battle? So I say, you can be on your iPad. And I said, you can have your phone. But the very next morning, I take that phone. And I can see who snapped at what time. I can see where she texted X, Y, and Z. And she doesn't have, like, Instagram and some of those other ones. But I can see it. And I am amazed at how many people will snap my daughter. Her age, she's only 14. Snap her at 11, 12 midnight, 1 a.m., I mean, she's not answering it. I could tell she's not opening it. But I'm like, what are you doing up? Like, what are you doing up at this hour, like, snapping? Like, what is it that you need at this point in the night that you're doing this? It's just poor.
Hey, Donna, does your kid resent the fact that you check her out in the morning, or is she accepting of that?
I said to her, these are the rules because I need to know that you can sleep.
Good for you.
Because sleep is, so it's a learning lesson for her. How do you do self-care? How do you take care of your sleep? So she's angry about it, sure. But she also knows after a couple of nights of she's being up at night doing that sort of thing, she's not herself either.
Yeah.
So she gets upset. And I also say to her, when you pay for the phone, I don't need to check it. But while I'm paying for the phone.
It's my motto. Donna.
That phone is not for you. That phone is for me so I can get in touch with you.
Donna,
you
thanks.
For the phone, different rules.
Great
thanks.
Call. We appreciate it. We really appreciate it. Donna, thank you. Amber from Worcester texts and says, if my 17-year-old nephew is on his phone 8 hours a day, as you say, then why does it take him 2 days to text me back?
Well, I guess that says something about the quality of the relationship there. But, you know, there was another one of these studies, too, that talked about it just limiting kids by an hour a day.
No, to an hour a day, not by an hour a day. Am I wrong about that?
I thought it was just limiting them by an hour a day.
Well, by an hour a day, they'd still be doing 7 hours. That's
right,
not exactly.
But, well, I'll go back and double check it. But the point is that limiting it does make the kids feel better about themselves.
Well, this is a recommendation, I think, from the American Psychological Association. Another recommendation, I can't remember if I said this on air to you, is you have an off day where it's not just reduced. There's 1 day a week. Even let the kid pick the day. And during that day, there's no phone use at all. That's a really tough one. I'd be interested to hear if anybody's been
able to. You have to do it during the week because this filmmaker, Tiffany Slane, said she was doing a tech Shabbat from Friday evening to Saturday evening. But that's the main socializing time for the weekend for the kids. So you'd have to do it during the week.
Where do you want to go?
Let's go to Ian in Revere. Hi, Ian.
Hello, Ian.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that although it is very important for kids and teens to have boundaries and rules and, you know, follow them in whatever household they're in, I also think it's important that if you notice kids getting depression or whatever from these social media apps, that maybe it's not just the social media, and
that's
taking that away
point.
Could also add to the more about teaching kids coping mechanisms and seeking out certain avenues to maneuver these feelings and issues.
Wait, what do you do? It sounds like you do something for work that has a relationship to this. Am I right?
No, not at all. I'm not an expert in any field.
Neither
That's
are we.
That's my kind
so
of guy.
We're in the right place, Ian. But what kind of things are you thinking about, though? Like what?
In terms of either counseling at school, group activities, things like that. I've read, it feels like there's a alarmist response to social media and its effects on youth. I think
but Ian, if I have to say, I'm no expert on this at all either, but I would say you're half right. The half right is don't assume that there are not other factors that are causing some mental health issues. But I assume you'd agree, Ian, that 8 hours a day, which is the average, which means a lot of people doing more, 8 hours a day on your phone is excessive regardless of what the reality is. No?
I do agree with you for our generation, but I don't know what the future of American life is going to look like. And just because it's appalling to us doesn't mean we should be shaping or shaming whatever the future generation.
I got it. You're a really good caller, but let me take one more cut at this. If you're spending all that time on your phone, that is time you're not spent talking or relating to another physical human being or human beings in front of you. You would agree, I assume, that that does inhibit your social growth. Do you buy that one or no?
I disagree. Because in social media, you are learning thoughts and viewpoints from other people. You are getting cultured in a way. I think it's just another element to human life in the modern age.
So you spend, what, about 15 hours a day on your phone, Ian?
if I didn't have a job, I would.
Hey, Ian, yeah, it was a great call. Thank you for making it. Appreciate it.
Okay, we are talking about navigating technology as a young person. More of your calls and texts are coming up. I just want to say one thing in terms of what Ian had to say, which was a great call. That, I mean, unless everybody's lying here in these studies, that the big change has been since 2008, loneliness, sadness, suicide rates, mental health problems. So what, you know, it, we all had phones before that. We had cell phones before that. We had computers before that. We had, obviously, TV and radio before that. So what happened in 2008? And the argument is that it's the introduction of smartphones. Anyway, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie, and I am Jim Browdy. We're at the library our usual days this week, tomorrow and Friday. We're also at the library on Thursday for a special edition of the show. That's because it will be Ask the Governor. This Thursday, Maura Healey joins us for an hour of your questions and calls. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new study out of the American Psychological Association that found teenagers who cut back on screen time to about an hour a day found themselves feeling less anxious and less self-conscious. Some schools are banning smartphones, as we said, during school hours. Give us a buzz or text us at 877-301-8970. Does that resonate with you? Marjorie, are you there? Because you went down.
Yes, I am.
I want to tell you something. I want to comment on your notion that it had to be something else since this all started in 2008. Do you know what year the iPhone was released, the first iPhone?
What year?
2007. So the answer is it's directly connected.
Yeah,
iPhone
well,
led to the explosion of smartphones more than anything else. So that's perfect symmetry with that.
Well, that's what these sociologists are arguing, that it's not, you know, it's not comparable to previous things.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying the obvious. I thought you said it predated. My apologies.
Oh, no, just the opposite.
Okay.
That it's related to iPhones and smartphones.
I'm sorry. Lauren in Boston, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
If you said, can you hear me? Yeah, we can.
Yeah. All right, so... Do you remember when cigarettes were okay for kids and they were good for you?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about good for you, but I remember when kids were doing them like crazy, yeah.
Well, okay, so cigarettes were not regulated, and there wasn't a ban on cigarettes, and being smoking all the time was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, we got to catch up with this. Eventually, we're going to find out. I argue that there's going to be a reckoning with these companies and with social media and with the phones that – this addiction, this usage is not good for us. And think about it. Everything else that's addictive, gambling, cigarettes, drinking, drugs, they're regulated. But this thing that I have in my hand right now with all these addictive programs on it is not regulated. And now now the studies are coming out, but there will be more. And I believe it, and there should be, simple laws that should be regulated. Why, you don't have to be a kid and have a phone. It just shouldn't happen. I don't believe that there's.
Well, I'm a big government kind of guy, and often criticized by Marjorie for it. Are you suggesting there should be an outright ban on people under a certain age using a smartphone, sort of like alcohol?
I believe that. I'm going to go there and say, let's just say that, you know, a five-year-old doesn't need a smartphone. I don't know what the age is.
I got it. And you know what, Lauren, thanks for the call. I thought where you were going, Lauren, and maybe you were too, is how we learned whether it's climate change, whether it's smoking, that the executives in these industries knew how addictive their product was, and in fact made it as addictive as possible. I thought Lauren might say that maybe we're going to find out in a couple of years, maybe we already know, and I just don't know, that the makers of smartphones and that sort of thing know how to make them as addictive as possible and so that people use them, particularly kids, as much as possible, so that becomes a lifelong behavior.
Well, you know, I live next to 2 doors from an elementary school,
and
the kids, I think there's some preschoolers in there, but boy, kids are walking by my house every day looking at their phones. They are little pints of peanuts. So a lot of parents are giving their kids cell phones at a very early age. And you hear parents say, well, that's because suppose there is an emergency. And I always think, well, if there's an emergency, they can call the principal's office and get the kid. Can't they do that?
Well, in addition to, I thought you were going to say, is for about 14 billion years, we all were parents and our kids didn't have smartphones and we did sort of okay or no?
Well, more or less.
More or less,
I guess,
depending
okay.
on it. Okay, 877-301-8970. Where would you like us to go next, friends?
Yep.
Could someone give us a hint here? Okay,
Matt
there we are.
McCarr. Matt McCarr.
Hey, Matt, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having this is my second time calling.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks a lot.
I'm wondering how, I don't know how detailed this study is, but I'm curious about if it covered the socioeconomic aspect of the, you know, the kids that were involved, you know, that they, you know, how they conducted this study, because I was really surprised by that number. The number of hours seemed very high to me. And that's because I'm fortunate enough that I work in some affluent neighborhoods in, you know, around here. And the kids that I work with, they just don't have time to spend, you know, that much time to spend on their phone after school. They're off to karate, they're off to soccer, they're off to piano lessons, you know, all these activities. They come home, they have dinner, they do their homework, and then it's pretty much time for bed. And I'm wondering, you know, those families can only do that. They're involved in those activities because they can afford to do so, you know. And if they're not involved in those activities, is that, you know, they're not on their phones while they're out in the soccer field. They're not.
Well, for whatever. All we read was a summary of the American Psychological Association study. I think I've read stuff in the past, I'm sure you have too, about how obviously ownership declines based upon a decline in income. But you're talking about having other activities that might. But like homework, you mentioned a minute ago, Matt, I would assume that every Gen Zer, or practically every Gen Zer, unless prohibited by their parent, has right next to their homework seated their phone, which they're probably tapping on regularly to see if there's a text or anything else that was sent to them.
See, and I can only speak from my personal experience.
Sure.
Because I not only work in the classroom, I'm a music teacher, so I also work with kids on a one-on-one basis in their homes, and a lot of them have siblings, and you know, again, only my experience, but the parents are usually pretty strict about, you know, you need to focus on your homework. If they have any sort of electronic device, it's there specifically to assist them in their homework. They're, you know, not allowed to get on their phone, be chatting or anything like that. So, and even if they were, I mean, how much of that time is contributing to, what, 8 hours? I mean,
but you're probably talking about the kind of parents who are very strict about television, who are very strict about a lot of things. You know what I mean, Matt? And I think that may not be the vast majority of people. I mean, the people that my kids grew up in Brookline, and I know there are lots of parents in Brookline who hardly ever let their kids watch television, and they did pretty well. But I don't know that that's going on across the country. You know what I mean?
But, Matt, the answer to your question is they don't do a socioeconomic breakdown. While you're talking to Marjorie, I just checked, and at least I don't see it. But an interesting point, Matt. Thanks for making it. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Even if Matt's right and it's not 8 hours a day, and I buy the research from the American Psychological Association, it's a significant number of hours that I assume most people would agree is way too much. The question is, how do you, as a parent, how do you convince your kid that these are the rules? And I, as an earlier caller said, Marjorie, saying, I'm paying for the phone, so until you're paying for it.
I like that
it's
one.
It's my rule. Yeah, but would that have persuaded your three kids? I'm not sure it would have persuaded mine too.
Well, I don't know. I think you just have to play hardball and say, you're not having electronics in your room.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You're just not. I mean, and if you start it early enough, it becomes a expectation. Then they complain to, you know, what a terrible, strict parent you are, and then you just have to.
What's an example of what you did, a similar thing, pre-smartphone, with your three kids when they were little, where you said absolutely no X,
well,
and
I
they listened to you?
It never happened, Jim. That's
exactly.
I mean,
nor with me, so I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I mean, when a parent calls and says that on the phone, I am jealous that they have that kind of relationship, that they're able to pull that off. I can't. We have time for one more call, Marjorie. Your call.
Okay, let's go to Rama in the car. Thank you, Rama.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Yeah, do you think Steve Jobs is in heaven? And if he is he sleeping at night? I don't know.
Well, you know, Rama, Steve Jobs is one of the people who was very strident about limiting his kids' access to all kinds of electronics.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's an upper echelon kind of thing. Yeah, our kids are going to be smart. They're not going to be on the phone all day or their iPad or whatever.
A lot of people, yeah, a lot of people don't have TV. They grew up some of the smartest people in the world. But I think my point is, I just want to make adults. I was just at Starbucks a little while ago. Everyone walking in there of any age is just looking at their cell phone. One of the things I try to do, I do my best, is to not be on my gadget on my cell phone when I'm in public, because I've had situations where I've missed a connection with a fellow human being. So the adults, we have to look at our adults, us, modeling the behavior for our kids, our nieces, our nephews, our grandkids. You know, we're the ones. And yes, Marjorie, we can play hardball. We should play hardball. We should ban cell phones under 18. Yes, yes, yes. And the adults, we have to look at ourselves. The adults are modeling this awful, awful, awful behavior. No.
That's a perfect way to end this, by the way. We have seen the enemy, and it is us.
Well,
you are totally right. Thank you,
Rama.
Rama,
I went to a comedy thing last night. Brian was with me, our producer here, and they took away everybody's phones and put them in cases. Mm-hmm. And people were quite upset about this. You know, they were not going to be able to use their phones during the show, and they had a phone-free use where you get up and you gave one of the employees your case, and he opened the case for you, and you could make your phone call. Yeah, so people were very upset about
that?
It.
People couldn't wait another hour?
There was a big line in the phone use circle of people to go up and do and make their phone calls. But listen to this from Dan Randolph. We'll end on this note, Jim. My son is a Boston Public School theater teacher. He bans phones in his class, but word got around, of course, and sign-ups for his course this year plummeted. So there you go. The kids just don't want to do it, Jim. The kids don't want to do it.
By the way, we have a variation on at the end of the show. We're going to invite your calls on another phone-related thing about the value of phone calls at all as compared to texting, sort of a variation on a theme.
Okay, coming up, two local Ukrainians we've spoken to before about the war in Ukraine when it first began. We're going to check in with them again 1 year into Russia's brutal invasion. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are live at the library 3 days this week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, Thursday. The governor joins us for an hour. You know, Friday marked the one-year anniversary of Russia's brutal, deadly invasion of Ukraine, this military incursion that Putin and his cronies thought would be quick and that Ukraine would fall. Well, as you know, a year into the invasion, it's almost exactly the opposite. We've seen ordinary Ukrainians do extraordinary things, fight for democracy, so far holding off Russia's march west. As we enter year two, what do the people in Ukraine need going forward? What are they experiencing beyond the television reports we hear at night? And do we need to be doing more than we are doing? Joining us now are two people we've talked to before, Sevelod Petriev and Tatiana Litus. Sevelod is president of the Boston branch of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. Tatiana is a 25-year-old student from Ukraine living in the Boston area. Both were at yesterday's rally at Copley Square, and they join us now. Welcome back to both of you. It's really good to see you.
Good to be back.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Tatiana, the last time we spoke with you, I believe you told us that your parents were still in Ukraine. Are they still there? And if so, what's going on with them?
Well, the situation changed drastically when the winter came. It started being cold, no electricity. My parents are from the capital, and the situation there wasn't that good. So they decided to go and be the refugees in Germany. So they are in Germany right now.
Do you have family? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is the situation in Germany okay, at least temporarily, or are they in a place that is not very comfortable or welcoming?
People in Germany are very welcoming, and they are now in the refugee camp, both of them. My dad is old enough to leave the country, so they are both right now in Germany in the refugee camp, and they are experiencing only good help.
Good.
And welcoming people.
Tatiana, one more thing for you. How do they feel about leaving their own country?
Well, that was definitely a hard decision for both of them. And they don't know what will happen in the future and when they will be able to come back. So it's pretty hard. They miss home so much. But they both lost their jobs. So that was the only way to go now. So,
Sevelo, I know it's hard to generalize, but of the people with whom you're in touch still in Ukraine, what do you hear?
They're committed to finishing this off. I mean, I'm in touch. I have family there also.
Mm-hmm.
And we speak, we try to speak on a weekly basis, but with all the electricity coming on and off, it's been a little hectic. But they're still there. They're still committed. And actually, the family that was in Chernihiv that had left Chernihiv during the heavy fighting is back there already. Their building did not get blown up, so they're back.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things I think a lot about when I watch the images at night on television is we see unimaginable strength and courage from everybody from President Zelensky on down to just average people trying to live their lives. But that's just a snapshot. And I wonder, when you have to deal with no electricity, food shortages, sirens going off all hours of the day and night, and, you know, crossing your fingers, hoping that you or your loved one is not going to be injured, life on the ground has to be incredibly difficult and stressful, no?
I'm sure it is, yes. I know it is. I mean, we've lost one family member, not directly related to the war, but she never quite recovered from the death of her husband back in 2014, when he was in the service. It is hard, but they're a tough people, and we can't even... We finally sent a package because we got them to tell us what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's even hard to do that. They're just, yeah, we're here. We're good. We'll take care of it.
Tatiana, you're 25 years old. What do you hear from your young friends, people that you grew up with, went to school with, about how they're doing? I've heard wildly different things from people able to go to work, able to go to restaurants, able to go out about their lives, and then people freezing because it's so cold. So what do you hear?
Yeah, so recently I called my friend, and I was expecting for her to be very sad and being cold in the apartment. But the first thing she told me, you know what? Now I know how to make coffee on the candle.
Oh,
and I don't know, it put me in tears on how happy she was because of that. So people are trying to find the happy moments, the little happy moments in their lives. And the situation is still very hard. They go to the coffee shops to work because there are electricity generators mm-hmm. in coffee shops. And they're trying to do their best. I think the situation right now is getting better in the capital. So they're coming back to kind of like a normal electricity life. But generally, I think it's still pretty hard.
You know, speaking of things getting better in the capital, you know, Sevelod, Marjorie and I talked a lot on the air about President Biden going in this secret
yeah.
effort to Kyiv. And I have to say, I was, as a cynic, and I'm a cynic about almost everything, I really was moved by the image of the two presidents standing with each other. What kind of effect does that have on the spirit of the people there who we're talking about?
I think it had a major effect. I haven't talked to them since that trip, so I don't know exactly what the effect was. I know it had a major effect on us here.
So, how about you, Tatiana? Have you spoken to anybody since Joe Biden was in Kyiv?
Yeah, I talked to my parents about that, and they are actually very happy about this. But the happiest person who was I was talking to was my husband's grandpa, and he loves that the president came. He loves that he greeted our president. He loves that now it feels more connected. And he was in the military service a long, long time ago, so he understands how important it is that the president himself came.
Yeah.
So in terms of what's going to happen down the road, you know, you've heard people say things from it's not going to end until Putin is no longer the president, is no longer in charge of Russia, that things could get a lot worse for Ukraine if China helps Russia with arms, that if we don't give, if the United States doesn't give F-16 fighter Falcons to Ukraine, they're not going to be able to prevail. What do you, Tatiana, what do you hear people say?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people agree that it will not end very soon, but we don't think that we can expect someone will help Russia. At this point, people from Ukraine and people in Ukraine believe that Russia is the only fighter over there for themselves. So we really believe that it will end, but not that soon. And there will be no help for Russia, only for Ukraine.
We're speaking to Sevalod Petriev, who is the president of the Boston branch of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, and Tatiana Litas, who is a 25-year-old student from Ukraine who is living in the Boston area. You know, Sevalod, the United States, through Joe Biden, has done a pretty remarkable job keeping much of the Western world together and in support of Ukraine. But we talk a lot on the show, and I'm sure you think a lot about, is it enough? There are some requests that have been made by President Zelensky that our United States and allies are saying no to, at least for now, planes in particular. Is the United States doing enough to ensure that Ukrainians win this war?
It's a hard question. I heard a quote that the Americans usually do the right thing, but they usually try things, everything else they can do, and then they do the right thing. So I think they will support Ukraine as needed. And they should be supporting faster, but they're not. But they'll get there. But Ukraine will survive.
How about it, Tatiana?
I mean, the stakes have gotten higher.
Of course.
I thought about difference between the last time we talked and now. And in fact, the last time we were talking, it was if Russia stops fighting, the war is over. If Ukraine stops fighting, Ukraine ceases to exist. Now, Russia has to stop fighting and withdraw for the war to be over. And the stakes have gotten up there.
Tatiana, what do you feel about the United States' contribution in this effort?
Yeah. I feel like United States is helping a lot. Honestly, right now, a lot of Ukrainians here in the United States also got their protected statuses, their documents. We feel that people are welcoming us here. So first of all, the help here in the country is quite significant. And the help that United States provides to Ukraine also is quite high. I hear people in Ukraine talking about United States and how they are helping so much. So people noticed your help, and people are very grateful for that. So thank you, everyone who is listening, who is helping us.
Our colleague Sarah Betancourt here at GBH wrote a piece about Ukrainians who are here now in the United States facing an uncertainty about how long they're going to be able to stay in the United States. She spoke with one family that they were allowed to stay for a year, and the clock is running out for them on April 16th. Another family, 2 years, but it's certainly not enough. I don't know where this family April 16th is going to go if we say they can't stay. So what is going on with that, Sevalod? I mean, it seems we should be doing more on that front.
I get to not say thank you and say we're doing more. But true, we do. So I'd want to say thank you first. But yes, there is work happening. I mean, when refugees first started coming, they couldn't work. They couldn't, kids couldn't get to school. The sponsors had to cover all medical costs. Those things have been changing. And so I'm faithful that, or I believe that we will adjust as the realities need to get adjusted. But somebody needs to be paying attention. And there are, the national part of my organization is working on that. Razum, some of the bigger national groups are doing that. And trying to advocate to make sure that things work well.
You know, Tatiana, while you both sound hopeful about the future, and I sure as hell hope you're both right, when you see an image on television of a place where you either lived or spent some time or vacation that has been totally destroyed for no reason, and human and infrastructure damage is immense, how do you deal with that? What's your reaction to that image on your screen?
It used to be harder before to see those images. My friend's house was destroyed. The park that I used to walk and play as a child was partially destroyed. So it was very hard before. But now we feel strong enough to overcome that and to rebuild that. So even though I feel pain looking at those pictures again and again, every morning I see them on social media, every morning someone sends me a message of something being destroyed. But as you told before, we are very hopeful that it will end soon and we will rebuild it even better.
You know, Sevalod, we hear a lot about what Tatiana was just saying about people being hopeful and that things could be rebuilt and stuff. You know, a lot of us here in the United States, if we're behind a school bus on the way to work, we're upset for the whole day because we're delayed for 10 minutes. You know, we really are spoiled rotten. But I wonder if you're an older guy. I mean, is there something that you saw in your friends and family in Ukraine that made them uniquely suited here? Or do you think it's just that when you're invaded, you all come together and can turn and do things you never thought you were capable of?
I think the history is different. I mean, the war has been going on for 9 years. Everybody has memories of World War II, those that have survived. And if not, the Ukrainians tell stories. I mean, life is it's a group that does sort of talking and storytelling, not only just reading in books. And so you know the stories. You know the stories of World War I. You know the stories of the Cossacks. You go back to the Vikings, blah, blah, blah. You know, that it's a struggle that's been going for a long time. And so they know how to get it together and keep going because they've been doing it for centuries.
You know, Tatiana, someone who's fairly new to this country, you that is, do you stop to think about the comparison between your fellow Ukrainians who are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of democracy in a country where you're now living, where democracy in most of our minds is hanging by a thread, and a lot of our fellows here don't seem to honor it? Do you think about that juxtaposition, that contrast?
Well, honestly, I was not thinking about contrast, but about collaboration more, because we are striving towards something that America already has, the freedom, the democracy, and we have the same values, and we're in the middle of the fight for it. So it's more of the inspiration, I think, for me and for a lot of my friends back in Ukraine. We've always seen America as an inspiration before, and it is now for us an inspiration as well. So I would say that it's more of the collaboration and friendship.
You know, we are in awe of Zelensky on this side.
Yeah.
What's quickly, starting with you, Tatiana, and then Sevelod, did you think President Zelensky had this in him when he was elected?
Can you please repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Did you think that President Zelensky, when he was first elected as an actor,
comedian,
had the kind of strength and leadership skills that he has proven to have?
To be honest, I think that no one expected him to be like that. That no one expected him to stay, first of all,
yes,
and fight
exactly.
for freedom. I didn't believe that any politician in Ukraine can be as strong. But right now, I truly believe that there are a lot of people over there in the politics that can do great things. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud to have such a president.
How do you feel about President Zelensky, Sevelov?
I'm sort of in the same position. I mean, I was very nervous about the cabinet he was picking around him, you know, prior to the war. It was like, oh, this isn't going to be good. And once the war started, you know, his charisma, his thing, and he had no other choice, came together, and he's done it. He's done an excellent job.
Has he ever? What a leader, what an example for the rest of the
done
world.
An excellent job.
Yeah.
Really Sevelod and Tatiana, we hope to speak to you again soon. We really appreciate you checking in. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Sevelod Petriev and Tatiana Litus. Sevelod is president of the Boston branch of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. Tatiana is a 25-year-old student from Ukraine who's living here in the Boston area. And thank you very much again, and good luck to your families and all your friends that are over there and to your whole country. Coming up, Angelo Carasone runs Media Matters for America. He'll join us on how Fox News knowingly helped spread Trump's lies about the 2020 election. In other words, they knew it wasn't stolen, and they lied about it anyway. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. The legal walls are closing in around Fox News executives for how they helped spread Trump's lies about the 2020 election, even though they knew them to be untrue. Angelo Carasone runs Media Matters for America. We'll get his thoughts. And we've still got more than a month until Easter, but that doesn't mean you need to hold off celebrating. How about Peeps flavored Pepsi? We'll get food policy analyst Corby Kummer on that horrible idea, plus food stamp recipients about to take a huge hit.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Village Voice Poetry, celebrating Black History Month with presidential inaugural poet Richard Blanco. After that, the Reverends Zaria Monroe and Emmett G. Price III on evangelicals packing their bags and moving to Idaho, the Kung Fu Nuns of Nepal, and the controversy sparked by racist remarks from Dilbert's creator. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow, and we're also going to be there on Thursday because we're going to be interviewing the governor of the Commonwealth, Maura Healey, and our usual day, Friday, as well. Hello again, Jim.
Hi there. And Thursday is Ask the, it's not just an interview, but it's Ask the Governor, where you'll get an opportunity to ask your questions as you do every month. So it was the $1.6 billion elephant in the room over at Fox News. Until yesterday's show, their Sunday afternoon program, Media Buzz, was barred from covering a defamation lawsuit against the network by Dominion Voting Systems for how they handled Trump's lies about the 2020 election. Here's host Howard Kurtz speaking out against that gag order, explaining to viewers why his show has not covered the Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit.
I believe I should be covering it. It's a major media story, given my role here at Fox. But the company has decided that as part of the organization being sued, I can't talk about it or write about it, at least for now.
Here for that story and other insights in the world of, I guess, alternative facts media, we're joined now by Angelo Carasone, president of the nonprofit watchdog Media Matters for America. Angelo, it's a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I'm so upset about Fox News, I can hardly control myself. It's a 24/7 obsession with me. But this Dominion lawsuit involving the Dominion voting machines, which were trashed over and over again during these what appear to be lies that the Fox hosts were saying about their belief that the election was stolen and that these machines were faulty, plus the texts and emails, the internal communications have been uncovered from the hosts, would seem to indicate that Dominion has a pretty good chance in what is usually a really uphill battle to win a lawsuit like this. What do you think?
I think that's right. And I think that I'm glad these things are uphill battles. And that there's a really, really high standard for defamation or litigation against any kind of public commentary like this. I think it's good that there's a high standard. But in this case, because there is a high standard, there's an overwhelming amount of information that's come out. And when you look at it in total, it's pretty clear. The standard really is actual malice. You have to know that there was harm. The things you were saying were not true, and then you continued to say them anyway. And all along the process, one of the things that comes out is that Fox News knew, top to bottom, that the executives knew, that Murdoch knew, that the hosts knew what they were saying wasn't true at all, but continued to say it because it was what their audience wanted to hear, and also because it served their political interests. And I'll just wrap by saying that there's this one part that came out of the filing where Rupert Murdoch, who's the chair of Fox, asked the president of Fox News about all this kerfuffle that's going on and to say, hey, are we saying these things? Are we doing these things? And she sent him back a research file with 50 examples of them pushing misinformation about the election, of which a bunch of the Dominion claims were in there. It's like, wow, that's something we would produce, but good. Stark. Go ahead.
Jamie Raskin, I think I got him right, during the one of the impeachment trials, said, if this is not an impeachable offense, I don't know what is. I'll say the same about this. You said from New York Times versus Sullivan, actual malice is you do it with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. To paraphrase Jamie Raskin, if this is not defamation, then we should get rid of the defamation statutes. This is like a textbook case of knowing one thing and saying one thing in private and doing a 180 when you get on the television screen. No?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, and that's the other thing, is that they didn't just were doing these things when they knew better. There's actually text messages, which you guys were alluding to, where Fox hosts were actually talking about how much they didn't believe the very things that they were pushing. So there's another layer on top of this, which is that it isn't just that they were failing a standard. They put in a lot of their own personal impressions and reflections on it, which adds to the intensity of the defamation. They really were doing this.
You know, Angela, one of the Marjorie is just staying up at night praying or whatever she does that they lose the suit.
I think many
people are with her. But one of the things that I also hope is that if they are to lose the suit, they being Fox News, that this has some sort of deterrent effect on similar behavior, because it is not only Fox News. There are a ton of these right-wing, fact-averse kinds of outlets now. Do you buy the notion this may have a deterrent effect on other similar deceitful efforts, or no?
It could. I mean, I think that it's a tough sell. I mean, I hope it does. And I think that there's a way that it could. The Jones stuff has what was the first real shift in this. And it's a little bit different, but I mean, the defamation there sort of changed.
As
some
in Alex,
of that
we're
programming.
Talking. Alex Jones.
Yeah, Alex Jones. That's right. Sorry. That's okay. And it's the same thing here. It's that, I think that they would have to see, one, that there was consequences, and two, that Fox was actually hurt in some way, that it didn't actually end up with them being profitable. So I guess my short answer is it really depends on the next year. Because we will ultimately decide what happens here. Fox is renewing all their cable contracts. If they are successful at renewing their contracts, not just renewing them, but what they're trying to do is get these really big increases. That's where most of their money comes
from.
Fox News actually doesn't
need
any commercials.
Right.
You know, that's the dirty secret about Fox. They're really the only commercial media property that doesn't need a single commercial. In fact, they could have $0 in ad revenue and would still have a 90% profit margin. And if they're successful at increasing all these renewals, and they don't have any real effect on their bottom line, even if they lose the case, it won't serve as the deterrent effect, because what it'll tell other personalities is that dig in, respect your audience. One of the things that Fox was pushing as a slogan throughout this whole thing is every time they were pushing nonsense, they said, well, we have to respect our audience. So I think the lesson could be the opposite, that if Fox is successful at commercializing what this serving and catering, commercializing these lies, they'll be affected. If not, if they can't do that, it will have a deterrent effect. It'll ratchet down the temperature a little bit. And that's really all that matters, I think, when it comes to dealing with the right-wing media.
But if Dominion does lose, I think what it will say is to not just Fox, but all these other outlets around the country, you can know you're telling a lie. You can know the sky is blue, go on the air and say the sky is red, and cause considerable damage, not just to Dominion, but to the whole. I mean, many people would argue that January 6th came about because of this nonstop drumbeat of the election having been stolen. So you can do that and get away with it. I mean,
yes.
Which
and
is
in fact, they've taken that lesson. You know, there was some litigation in Florida a while back where Fox News was defending themselves against a bunch of defamation claims. And in the state court filings, they had argued that no reasonable viewer of Fox News primetime would assume what they're hearing is true, they were purely entertainment. And to your point, it did actually, in right-wing media, which is largely what I listen to every day, that is up there with the Bible for them.
Right.
Because they referenced that point as a sign of protection, that look at this, look how far they went. And ultimately, they were protected. And I do think the stakes are high in that sense. I will say on the other end, covering of this information, I think could change the way the rest of the media engages with Fox. You know, we didn't see President Biden, which happened right before this came out, sit down with Fox News. You know, part of what happens with
for
Fox
the Super
is
Bowl you're talking about. The Super Bowl,
yeah,
right?
Right. Significant. And Fox News is grandfathered in. Part of the reason there's less accountability is because they still get treated like a news outlet, even though they're in every way and every meaningful interaction much more like a political operation. So, if others change their behavior around Fox, it's a lot harder for them to maintain that veneer of journalism, which people still respect in this country. There are limits to what you're willing to do when you think you're going after a journalist outlet. You don't want to retaliate against journalism. And that's the struggle, I think, is that others have to change their behavior, too.
We're talking with Angelo Carasone. He's president of the nonprofit Watchdog Media Matters for America, which is a great operation. But I wanted to ask you, too, you mentioned about how you spend your time in right-wing media. I think we make the mistake sometimes of thinking that Fox News, that's it. But, as a caller once said to us a few months ago, if you drive through parts of Pennsylvania, all you can hear is AM radio with the same kind of craziness. I mean, so there's a huge echo chamber. Tell us about that.
That's it's an echo chamber. That's what gives it its power. And, up until recently, I think people forget that for 25 years, Rush Limbaugh was the single largest get out the vote operation in the country.
Yeah.
But he was also the assignment editor for the very echo chamber that you talked about. Because, his fans literally call themselves ditto heads.
Right.
That I would echo the thing you say on air. That happened. So when Limbaugh would sort of be the ultimate referee, that was then amplified and echoed through much of the right-wing echo chamber, which is what gives them their power, that repetition. And the role that Fox has increasingly played is that they sort of function in helping sort of sift. They're like a front page editor, of a newspaper. They sort of pick what are the big things that we can rally around, because they get the large political guests, and that then gets reverb. Talk radio talks about the Fox News segments with those hosts that they, or those appearances. So the echo chamber is much more important than just a few of these outlets. And just to put a bow on it, part of the reason we're having this very conversation in the first place about Dominion and Fox is precisely because of the dynamics of that echo chamber. Fox News accepted the results of the election for a brief period of time. And then One America News and Newsmax, two competitive news channels, were out there nipping at their heels. And Fox News, on a dime, we watched it in real time. They went from accepting the results to then on the following 2 weeks in November doing 774 segments undermining the election, including much of this Dominion coverage. So they were responding to the dynamics within this echo chamber so that they didn't lose their seat. But that's it. And what I think is significant is that right now we're in this moment where while they're simultaneously more bloodthirsty, they don't actually have a Limbaugh. Tucker is sort of moving into that role, and I think you sort of see that played out most recently with this McCarthy news, but they don't actually have that center of gravity yet, and that echo chamber does have the potential to just sort of scatter and have lots of little different narratives, where instead of it being an echo, it's a noise, and that means that they could be much weaker.
What about Limbaugh's replacement, Dan Bongino, I think his name is? I mean, he has millions of listeners, I believe.
He does.
And Glenn Beck has got significant audience. I mean, it's when you look at the numbers, there are millions of people that are tuning into these little baby Fox imitators.
It's true. The audience matters. When I think about the role that Limbaugh played and others, though, it's kind of like a herd of cows, or any herd.
Okay.
You need a lead steer. The lead steer determines the direction of the herd. And if you have two steers that are fighting, the herd just kind of stands there and wanders. Maybe they break apart. You still have big cows, right? But you don't have a leader. You don't have a direction. You don't have a herd. And Glenn Beck is not a lead steer. He had a brief moment back in 2009 to 2010, but he doesn't drive coverage. He echoes. And that's the same with Dan Bongino. He is basically like the Drudge Report, but with a radio show. Most of what he does is aggregation. He's talking about other people's stuff. His audience matters in the sense that he can help saturate and repeat, but he is not a driver of news. He doesn't really determine where things go. And Tucker does in large part right now. And Joe Rogan a little bit, even though he's not exactly part of the right-wing media, he has so much cultural impact that it's kind of felt. But they're struggling in that way. And I'm not someone who just gets out there to own people because it's the truth. It's a fascinating moment in this right-wing media. And it's actually happening right at the same time. All these changes in that landscape are happening right when Fox News is at its very, not weakest, but they're walking a very fine line between Trump and DeSantis and the primaries. And at the same time, what they can and can't say because of this litigation and navigating this tumult. And so it's a weird moment in right-wing media where they don't have a clearly defined center of gravity. It'll probably end up being Tucker, but it is not clear yet. And that really does have – and you see these things bubble up, like the McCarthy fight was sort of an offshoot of these factions kind of generating, sort of going at it. But it is a really transformative period that will then determine what the next few decades actually look like. And this Dominion case is happening – at an especially critical time.
Being forced to watch and listen to right-wing media, I believe, is defined as torture under certain international conventions, Angelo. So speaking of Tucker Carlson and speaking of the speaker, McCarthy, I think everybody knows that he gave exclusive access to thousands and thousands of hours of January 6th footage, which is sort of ironic considering the guy he gave it to is been saying it was a false flag operation by the government. Here is Carlson speaking on Fox News about why he should have unrestricted access to that footage.
Big picture, if you don't want another January 6th, if you want to avoid another riot like that, you'd want as much of the footage to come out as possible. Instead, our government has been using the information blackout it claims is necessary for national security in order to do what they usually do under the cover of classification law, and that's lie to us.
Does this worry you, this exclusive access given to Carlson? And if it does,
yeah, it's terrifying.
How and why?
It really does. Because we already have a keyhole view of what this will look like. Because about a year or so ago, Tucker Carlson did a three-part documentary about January 6th called Patriot Purge, in which he basically argued that January 6th was a false flag operation, sort of a fake put-up job either by Nancy Pelosi, Democrats in the media, but that somehow it was all the FBI was involved, according to him. And that basically was a setup to crack down on conservatives and Trump supporters. And it was pretty devastating. I mean, false flag, claiming things are a false flag is a really extreme charge because it works up the most extreme people. And he didn't really have anything to go on there. I mean, he had nothing. He had no raw material. He just had questions, innuendo, and a couple of extremist experts people he identified as experts. In this case, he has a ton of raw footage that he can edit, selectively edit, to validate, to build the case that he started making about a year ago. And so essentially it worries me for a few reasons. One, we're relitigating what happened on January 6th. And we're doing it in a way that is not transparent. You know, they're calling it transparency, but it feels much more like a transaction than transparency. And I heard Dean Obadiah, who's a radio host, say it that way. And I thought that was so smart because that's what it feels like. It feels much more like a transaction than transparency. So that's the first piece. The second part is that it's specifically going to activate the very malicious, militarized groups, militarized extremists that have sort of been waiting for the proof. That it was a false flag operation. So, you know, I think that even though it feels more stable right now and the environment has sort of ratcheted down, that cauldron of extremism, hate, of violence is still simmering. And it doesn't mean that we should be scared about it all the time, but it's still simmering. And Tucker is about to raise that temperature a lot so that it boils over. And it's specifically designed to cater to the most extreme audience.
Well, this
so
is
I
what
worry
your,
about it from that perspective.
This is what your government wouldn't allow you to see. And I'm going to have you. So there it goes.
Angela Corazon from Media Matters. I know you're not a psychologist, but I'm endlessly curious about Tucker Carlson. You know, Tucker Carlson used to be on MSNBC. If you listen to his monologues, he's very good at what he does. I can see why people get sucked in by him. But as we know now from his text messages, he knew he was lying about the election, admitted it, and did it anyway. So, I mean, what is the story with this guy? I mean, there's something.
Marjorie, you're acting like it's aberrational. We used to work with a radio host who was paid more than any radio host in town. Do you believe he believed anything he said?
You talking about Bill O'Reilly?
No, I'm not talking about Bill O'Reilly.
Because Bill O'Reilly was a great interviewer. You may not have liked him. He did some very bad things, needless to say, but he was a very good interviewer. But, I mean, this is so blatant because, as I said, it caused people to die. It caused a riot. It caused – so I guess he's a guy with no soul and no conscience or what?
I mean, I think part of it is to keep in mind is that there's a crop of these figures from the 90s. Tucker was a part of them. And I think this still happens in right-wing media, but I can only speak to them because there's been so much written about it from including from people that were from this group. It's ends justify the means. You believe that you're fighting for a righteous cause, so who cares?
Ultimately, right. It's like these takeover guys, Marjorie, who take over a company and fire 3,000 people.
But he knows he's not fighting for a righteous cause. He basically was mad, too, because they were losing audience share, right, to whatever it was, Newsmax, whatever it was. And he was worried about the money. That was one of the things he did reveal in the text, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and also, but I think a lot of it was tied into his power, too. You know, Tucker doesn't have a radio show. Unlike Hannity, unlike other Fox figures. You know, Mark Levin has a radio show. He has, you know, they have other ways of speaking to a large audience independent from their Fox show. Tucker's all in on Fox right now. He has his TV show, and then they use him pretty aggressively to convert people to Fox Nation. He doesn't have an alternative platform. Not that he necessarily wants one, but if the Fox brand goes sour too fast, he loses his people. So there's a self-interest.
You know, Angelo Carasone, there's a dreaded local angle to talk to you about briefly, too. Kurt Schilling, who helped this city win a World Series and was beloved, is, I think it's fair to say, he's a pretty much a QAnon type. Everybody here knows what Kurt Schilling is. What kind of audience is he about to get with this hiring by Fox Sports? What is it called, Outkick or something like that?
Yeah, he's going to get a pretty significant audience. And I think this is where a lot of things go in the future. I always look around what's around the bend. And part of the way that the right-wing media broadly is transforming, just because they have so many resources to do it, is that they've been putting a lot of money and time and energy into what we've been calling cultural crossovers. So these are figures that don't really identify as political first, but weaved into all of their other commentary, discussion. They're talking about political content or worldview sort of shaping content. And in a way, it's much more potent. You reach much wider audiences than people that just want straight political commentary. Yeah. And because it's not coming at them exactly always head on, it can be really powerful. And it's consistent. And you know, one of the most watched people on election night 2020 was this YouTuber, Steven Crowder. Guy had millions of viewers, maybe the most watched in the country, even though most people haven't heard of him. He used to be a gaming streamer. Most of his audience came from gaming. And it's the same thing here. that what he's about to get access to is a parallel audience tied into the Fox ecosystem that gets echoed through it, too. You know, they'll take that clip. It will make its way through all the Fox properties, too. We see it time and again on Fox and Friends on the weekends. They'll do news segments about it. And that it'll be another piece of this feedback loop. And he is about to be not, it's not just who he'll reach, but rather his own presence, who he is, what he's done in the past, will serve as validation within this larger feedback loop.
Angela, we really appreciate your time. That was great. Thanks so much. Good luck
with
your work.
Yeah, it was great. I very much appreciate your work. Somebody's got to be on top of this stuff, Angelo.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You too.
We've been speaking with Angelo Carasone. He is president of Media Matters for America. It's a great website. After quick break, we're not trying Pepsi's latest marketing stunt. At least I'm not going to try it. But you know what they've got? Not Pepsi-flavored soda, but Peeps-flavored soda. Corby Cummer is going to tell us about that and more news in the food business. Also, some great news about this women's event he's going to tell us all about. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. And a reminder, we're also live on Thursday, an unusual library day for us, for a special Ask the Governor. So this week, it's Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. We're joined now, though, on Zoom by Corby Cummer. Corby is the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hey, Corby.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Corby Cummer. Great to talk to you, as always. So this is a very upsetting story about food stamps, which have helped millions of people, including children, get out of poverty. What's going on?
Well, poverty ended practically. There was a tremendous amount of progress on child nutrition and poverty in general. We have to say, the Trump administration during the pandemic, somehow SNAP extensions got passed, and they made a tremendous difference in the lives of working families. And they showed that when you give people more food every month, you lift them out of poverty, you allow them to get jobs, they have better lives. And then the pandemic restrictions started coming to an end, and this week, it's the very end for 32 states that kept them, because a lot of states chose not to extend. They had the ability not to extend these wonderful raises and extensions of emergency food assistance. So there are a couple of things going on. One is that the Biden administration changed the basis on which all of SNAP is calculated. And so starting last October, there's a tremendous rise. Everybody got a raise who gets SNAP. It was, I think, a 12% raise. But the problem is food prices have gone up 10% in the past year. Yeah. This is really going to cover it. And so the drops are huge for these people who are suddenly going to see their benefits lower.
You know, a couple of things about this. One of the things that stunned me in our research, I don't want to vouch for this, but we did our best this morning. It appears that the only state, which again I find hard to believe, that is attempting to do some sort of bridge to this horrible reduction is Massachusetts. In Governor Healey's supplemental budget, there's some money to get to have an increased benefit for 3 months, sort of as an off-ramp. kind of thing. But this is like going out with a whimper, not a bang. This is a huge, huge development for tens of millions of people in this country. And it's almost like, well, another piece of legislation is dying kind of thing. It's a monster program. It's huge.
When Congress refused to extend the raises for SNAP last fall, hunger advocates started saying there's going to be a cliff. It's a hunger cliff. It's an income cliff. And people are going to go off it come the early spring. And it's happening this week. And you're right. It isn't getting enough publicity. And NBC News started doing it. And that's the story we're talking about now. Really well-reported story. But, you know, food banks are going to see demand raise exponentially. They're already seeing it. They're trying to lay in more food. One food bank in Florida, I think, is taking crates of sweet potatoes. That's great, and they're very nutritious, but stuff that they used to refuse because they didn't have the person power to package it and get it to people. Now they'll take anything. And so food banks have been in real trouble.
You know, this is more a political question than a food question, but, you know politics, Corby. I'll ask you anyway. You know, we have just taken away the child tax credit, which I think lifted, that was a pandemic thing, lifted almost, what was it, almost half the children
the
in America.
We got rid of the addition to the child
the
tax
addition.
Credit. It still
That's
exists,
correct.
But
yes,
the expansion.
Thank you, Jim. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, the additional money that went to the child tax credit, and we took that away, and it was once again with a whimper. There wasn't any big protest about it. Now SNAP again. You have to be left wondering, is it that we in the media don't publicize these things enough? Is it that people in the United States of America don't pay attention to what's going on in programs that affect them? Or what? I mean,
I think it's that poor people can't afford lobbyists. And yeah. So advocates just aren't funded enough to make enough noise to raise public consciousness. But the good news, which also wasn't particularly well reported, is that SNAP benefits, the increased ones, kept 4.2 million above the poverty line, lowered overall poverty by 10% and child poverty by 14%. That's huge.
One last thing, though. You say poor people don't have lobbyists. They actually have some, but you're right. They're dwarfed in terms of significance by the big boys and girls. Having said that, as you know, and you've taught us, SNAP benefits, food stamps, they're not just for the poorest of people.
No.
There are a lot of low yeah. and lower middle class. Why are you making a face like that?
What about this guy in the NBC News story, Charles Jones, 65-year-old U.S. military veteran in Rockford, Illinois? His enhanced monthly SNAP benefit was $281 under the temporary program, which ends this week. And his payments are going to go to $23.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's really, and now, by the way, I have to say,
to buy
we are lucky
$23 to get you through the week, never mind the month.
We are lucky that in this state, even though the Democrats don't have a majority in the House anymore, the single member of the 535 members of Congress who has been the most ardent, powerful, successful advocate on food issues is Jim McGovern from Worcester, who has been nothing short of brilliant through all the years he's been there.
A national hero.
Hey, I agree.
Corby Kummer, lots of talk now about the dangers of gas stoves, bad for the environment inside your house. They can be bad for the kids. Asthma has been associated with gas stoves, which I feel terrible about because I've had a gas stove forever. But anyway, this story in the Boston Globe by Deborah First, great reporter, talks about how electricity could be very expensive to run in restaurant kitchens that are trying to get away from gas stoves.
This was a really interesting story. Deborah is such a good reporter and writer, and this was full of reporting of local chefs. How is it to cook with electricity? Because it's been just an article of snobbish faith among foodies for decades. You have to cook on a gas stove. That's the only thing that allows real control. Electric stoves are primitive. You'll never get a good result if you can't suddenly raise and suddenly lower the heat. Melissa Clark of the New York Times last year sort of put paid to this, as the English said. She ended the debate, as far as I was concerned, because she spent 2 weeks cooking on an induction cooktop. If you've ever used those are ceramic. They're activated only when metal is on top of them. And she compared it to a gas stove for 2 weeks, and she said, my results were just as good on the electric induction burner. I was able to have subtle control. It was just fine. And it was so specific and so well done that I thought, okay, that's that. Dever goes farther, and she talks about the economics of restaurants that have to convert to electricity. So say that gas is safe. Say that you envision a tiny restaurant kitchen that's overcrowded with people, maybe not the best ventilation, that needs ventilation for these possible fumes from gas stoves. It's a good idea for them to be changing. But restaurants can't afford this switchover. It's enormously expensive to change to the electric stoves. And what's more, the power is so much more expensive than electricity. And so when foodies have been having their kind of national breakdown over New York City's prevention of new buildings to allow gas lines in, so nobody can have gas stoves anymore in new buildings, expensive co-ops in New York. You know,
in
we
Brookline,
were having
too. A lot of towns in Massachusetts too, right? That program.
Michelle Wu, the mayor, has announced that she's going to follow other cities which are announcing bans and timelines for ending it. I think 2025 rather, is it. But restaurants have faced such higher power charges. And I don't see in this story any state agency saying we're going to help subsidize the restaurant business because we're requiring them to spend so much more money.
You may ask you a question. Everyone, well, not everyone, but you and other people mentioned these induction cooktops. I assume that's because they don't want to have to get an entire new induction oven. So is that why they're using the cooktops as sort of a bridge gap?
No. Do you know, many, many people already have the electric oven gas stovetop. That's been sort of the foodie gold standard for decades.
Bravo.
You have an electric oven and you have a gas cooktop. And so cooktops are the ones that were sort of the last gasp for foodies. Restaurants, however, because gas is so much more less expensive and more economical to run, have been using gas ovens, you know, coal-fired ovens and pizza that are a cult in New York City. But most of those are gas-fired. And so it's going to be much more of an issue for professional kitchens than for home kitchens.
You know, one last thing about this for a second. I mean, obviously, I support the transition. I also support your notion there's got to be some help for these restaurants, particularly the independents. How about if you're cooking like on a wok, where it is important that flames
go up
the sides?
You brought up the exception. I don't know the answer to wok. So it's always the exception because they require enormous, powerful blasts to immediately stir fry vegetables in this really tender, crisp way. And Dever quotes one of the cooks at a Chinese restaurant saying, you know, I really need it for the wok. And that's about the only exception for gas.
Okay, I'm going to imitate Marjorie Egan right here. You ready, Corby? Can I ask you a question? Well, obviously you can. That's why he's here. Here's the question, Corby. The only thing worse, this is my thesis. Tell me if I'm wrong. The only thing worse than a peep is a peep in a Pepsi. That's almost like a truism, is it not?
But listen, as soon as you say it, I notice the alliteration.
Exactly. Thank you.
I would say it's a snappy jingle.
So what Pepsi is doing, I don't know if it's only around leading up to Easter or this is permanent. They're putting the flavor of those horrible marshmallow peeps, which according to those who've tasted this makes it taste like vanilla Pepsi, which I guess is not so horrible. This is obviously your dream come true because you're a big peep guy. Yeah,
the
peep
guy just died. You are leading the witness by saying what could be more horrible than a peep. I'm not going to go along with the premise of your question.
Fine.
So I like peeps. I like the whole texture of them. The flavor is kind of nothing to write home about or even to describe. And yet Pepsi is starting to do a brand extension for peeps by essentially having vanilla Pepsi. And the writer who did a whole taste test in MassLive.com said, you know, it's not bad. I like vanilla Pepsi. If you like vanilla Pepsi, you'll like peeps flavored Pepsi.
Do they squeeze the peep into the can or and what do they do? Or they borrow the flavor?
Welcome to the world of the food industry, Jim Browdy. Yeah. It's all essences and artificial flavorings in the first place. So all they have to do is extend them and put them into, you know, sugar water.
Okay.
You know, I love this piece by Nick O'Malley from MassLive because he points out that lots of people, I'm one of them, can't stand peeps. And he compares to Oreo cookies. You know, no one ever goes to the store, he says, and thinks, man, I've had a tough day. I could really crush a sleeve of Peeps right now.
You know, when it's full of good writing. Eating a Peep is like taking a bite out of insulation foam that's been rolled in sand from a beach in mid-March.
Exactly. I am surprised you, such a connoisseur of good food and good eating, would be into Peeps, Corby. I'm shocked,
it's
frankly.
Because of the sanding sugar and the texture.
All right.
Return to Corby Cummer. Speaking of other food, this one is not Peep-like. I've actually had this. Sir Kensington's ketchup is going out of business. The company's not going out of business. They're going to keep making mayonnaise and other things. But the ketchup is. I didn't buy it because there's no corn syrup. I know that should the fructose thing, which it is true it doesn't have. I bought it once only because it sounded great and thick. And it is fat. I don't know if either of you ever had it.
No.
It's terrific. But it costs twice as much as virtually any ketchup. Is that why they're having to dump the line? They just can't compete? What's the deal?
I didn't go online to find out what their endless announcement saying tragedy has struck America. We are no longer producing our ketchup. This story about it does not give the reason. I assume it's because, Jim, you had to pay twice as much and people weren't willing to pay twice as much for when they could have Heinz, which is, of course, the industry standard for the same amount. No matter which way you slice it or don't slice it, ketchup is mostly sugar. And so whether it's fructose, corn syrup, or some other sweetener or, you know, real wonderful cane syrup, it's sugar. And that's what people want. And so why should they pay more when they're used to the flavor of something else?
You know what I do? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this other story from Eat This, Not That. I've never heard of that. But they talk about the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and somebody put up a post called Sir Kensington's Ketchup, a Eulogy. And the co-founder explained that, you know, what you talk about a lot, the low margins in the food business. And they couldn't do it between the war, pandemic, and inflation.
You always the great thing about Sir Kensington was it sort of sprang from nowhere. It didn't have that much startup money, and it really did well. So it was a David and Goliath story that foodies celebrated for a long time.
Let me ask you, I've never said this on the air, but I guess because it wasn't relevant. What I did after I bought the Sir Kensington was too expensive. I went back to the Market Basket brand, is I squeezed a Peep into the ketchup. And I have to say, it gives it a taste and a texture that really is quite nice.
You could have single-handedly rescued Sir Kensington ketchup.
Had they called me.
Yeah, a certain zing from that little mixture of ketchup and Peeps. I mean, when is Easter? It's in March or April this
you
year?
You are asking when is Easter?
Well, it's
can I ask you a question, Marjorie? When is Easter?
32 days from now or something. I don't know the exact date.
Okay, fine.
But in any case, I mean, that's when they're all going to come out of the woodwork, as it were. We're going to be surrounded by these Peeps, these Peep dioramas. Remember, we had the woman from Hancock, New Hampshire. Yeah, with the Peeps
dioramas. Which is where our friend Cy hangs out.
That's right, in the library up there. So apparently there's a big Peep craze all across America. I don't get it. I never have, but that's just me. Okay. So tell us about this really nice restaurant in New York trying to unionize what's happened.
Well, let's say it's a really nice restaurant that is fighting a unionization effort by its small staff.
Upscale, I should have said. Upscale restaurant.
So big story in the past 2 years that I think we celebrate and are fascinated by is unionization of big chain restaurant workers. We've watched it in Starbucks. That's been the most famous. Starbucks and Amazon really have been the most famous test cases for unionization in service workers. The history of unionization in restaurants is mostly hotel restaurants. And I didn't realize this story, which was really interesting, talked about it was a badge of honor to put a union sign in the window of a restaurant in the 50s and 60s because, it was pride in working and wages. But at the same time, when I was doing a lot of reporting on restaurants, especially in New York City, I remember that restaurant owners would not bid on Tavern on the Green because it was a union shop and they said it was much too expensive to run. So the history since the 60s and onward has been, first of all, the turnover is so high in restaurants. Small independent restaurants have staffs that are too small to actually successfully organize. Lodi, a restaurant in New York City, a fancy Italian restaurant that serves, that charges $16 for chia pudding and then $66 for pork loin entrees, pays $18 an hour, which amounts to, if you work 40 hours a week, $37,000 a year. Imagine trying to pay the rent, let alone support a family in New York City for $37,000.
That's like your best friend, that guy from Europe, that's closing down his restaurant, the greatest restaurant in the world, where he has half of his people are interns who don't get paid. Only they only get abused. That's their what's that guy's name?
Rene Redzepi.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, Corby. If you're,
I just want to, Corby. It seems like that we're in an impossible place with restaurants because we constantly talk about the small margins, the lousy pay, how much it's going to cost to give people a better wage. I mean, either the restaurant prices are going to go way. I mean, it seems that they either have to go way up, or there's going to be a lot of restaurants that are going to go out of business. A lot of people aren't going to go to restaurants unless they're going to real, you know, like fast food. I mean, I don't know how this shakes itself out. You know what I mean? Unless you ply them with booze.
You just stated the problems really succinctly and well. They are in a very tough place. But I think they're going to have to reset diner expectations for levels of service. And diners are going to have to expect kind of less surprise and wow and tweezed food and fawning service unless they go to the few places that charge enough to actually cover that fawning service.
By the way, let me just say on this. My attitude about every workplace, I don't care what it is, including particularly independent restaurants, which I love and try to patronize, if you can't afford to pay your workers a living wage by doing something, whatever it is, raising the prices, adding a service, whatever it is, then frankly, you shouldn't be in business. I mean, it can't be, well, listen, I can't afford it, so I'm going to screw these people
but the problem
so that I can
is,
keep my restaurant
the
open.
The problem is the number of people that can go out and pay $250 yeah. for a dinner of four is very small. So it seems like there's a catastrophe waiting here for middle-of-the-road restaurants.
Jim said is right, that business models and business planning from the outset have to change and incorporate much higher and higher labor and probably smaller staffs.
Yeah, can I just say, we just got a Jamie, who was our lead producer here, just spoke to Jim McGovern's office. Here's the deal, and we also spoke to Governor Healey's office, that $130 million grant for this to pay 40% of the benefit that it's about to be reduced in food stamps is pending in the legislature. And according to Jim McGovern's office, the last emergency allotment is Thursday, March 2nd, which gets people through March. So if the legislature is going to do something and put it on Healey's desk to at least cushion the blow a little bit, it's got to be before the end of March. That's their deadline.
Which means if you're concerned about this, that you better call your legislature because they do almost nothing. 617-722-2000 is the number up at the State House, or you can email them as well. Obviously.
And if you don't know who it is, when you call that number, they'll tell you who it is.
Yes, exactly.
Corby, before you go, explain to what Let's Talk Women is. I bought a meal last year at this thing, and it was spectacular. Explain to people what it is.
So it's Women's History Month, and 19 of Boston's women-founded restaurants are offering sample dishes and many others. There's a benefit that starts at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 1, in which you can go and try these dishes at exploretalk.com, Let's Talk Boston. But the idea is that what catches my attention most is Boston has always been welcoming to women-owned restaurants and women chefs. It's been a national leader in women entrepreneurs and women businesses. And so you already patronized it and helped it
last year.
Jim, and tell me, I'm sure you had a wonderful meal, but there are so many important women in food in Boston, and they're helping out, including helping a benefit for the Women's Lunch Place.
By the way, and it's sort of fun, if you buy a ticket, they're not going to tell you to the last minute where the dinner is being held. Last year, you brought it home because it was still big time pandemic kind. But the meal was like from 10 different restaurants. It was great. This year, they're going to notify you at the last minute what the location is. And I happen to know.
If you've organized events, you know how valuable it is to build in surprise as in a feature, not a bug.
Wait a minute. You know what the restaurant is?
Well, only because
I
just got
an inside scoop?
No, I got it. No, it's not because I have an inside scoop. It's because since I gave last year, I guess people who contributed last year get an email in advance.
Oh, okay.
And it's a really nice place.
We'll talk about one on March 1. Let's talk about the benefit for the Women's Lunch Place, which is Wednesday, March 29. Go on to Women's Lunch Place. Tickets are $185. Fabulous women chefs, including Tiffany Faison and Lydia Shire. And they're going to base their dishes on the women who inspire them. Imagine how great that's going to be. And if you haven't volunteered or gone to Women's Lunch Place, this is the time to familiarize.
Yes, because last time I went, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they always had white tablecloths. They had little flowers and vases on the tablecloths. You could go there and take your shower. You could go there and hang around during the day because shelters close, right, in the morning. You got to get out.
It's a fabulous
so place,
place
to go during
and
the day.
Seen and beautifully run.
Corby,
right,
nice to
Street.
See you, Corby. Bye.
Thank you very much, Corby.
See you soon.
We've been speaking with Corby Kummer, Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, Senior Editor at The Atlantic, and a Senior Lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Coming up, to close out Black History Month, we're going to talk with inaugural poet Richard Blanco with some great poems in honor of Black History Month. That's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, not just tomorrow and Friday, but Thursday as well, because we'll be doing a special Ask the Governor with Maura Healey this coming Thursday. We're joined now for another edition of Village Voice with poet Richard Blanco. Richard is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history and the first poet laureate of Miami-Dade County. His latest book is How to Love a Country. Richard, good to see you.
Good to be here. How are you all doing?
We're good.
Great,
we're good.
Great. Richard, good to talk to you as always. So what is your theme, please, off Black History Month? What's it about?
Well, it's Black History Month. This is a longtime poet friend and someone who was actually sort of a mentor from afar, Toy Derricotte, just one of the iconic African-American poets of our country, born in 1941. Michigan, but settled most of her life. She's a professor emerita from University of Pittsburgh, and just writes about sort of some of the, passing sort of the trying to negotiate the space of race in this country and what is her experience. Black History Month, I just want to note, was really interesting looking at the history of it. And it actually began as a week, which is set around Lincoln's birthday and Frederick Douglass's birthday. So I'm learning a little bit myself. So
let me just say one thing about her. I read a lot of her stuff last night, beyond the poems you selected. And one of the things I love is when you can combine simplicity, and I think most of her poems are simple. I hope I got it right. With power, it's unbelievable. I mean, she is really something.
Oh, yeah. Well, before we get to the poems, I just wonder, is Florida allowed to celebrate Black History Month with Governor DeSantis in charge, or did he put the kibosh on that as well?
So far, he's on a rampage. But, the whole thing with the AP courses now in Black History Month, they had to revise. But besides that, there's the House Bill number 7, which is now in an injunction. Thank God. But you're not it's not that you can't teach something. It's it's very vague. It's vague to the point of evil. But you're not allowed to preference or promote all these kinds of verbs of anything that has to do with sort of basically making white people feel bad about themselves.
or what they consider to be white people feeling bad about themselves, which is a critical criterion.
And in essence, wiping away history or just not teaching it. So
it's amazing. The little fragile white children can't survive timeouts, you know, Richard. But let's get to the poems. Can we do passing first?
Sure, sure. Let's do that. And Jim is exactly right. The quiet power of poems that are seemingly simple, right?
Yeah. That's what I should have said. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Passing. A professor invites me to his black lit class. They're reading Larson's Passing. One of the black students says, "Sometimes light-skinned blacks think they can fool other blacks, but I can always tell," looking right through me. After I tell them I am black, I ask the class, "Was I passing when I was just sitting here before I told you?" A white woman shakes her head desperately, as if I had deliberately deceived her. She keeps examining my face, then turning away, as if she hopes I'll disappear. Why presume passing is based on what I leave out and not what she fills in? In one scene in the book, in a restaurant, she's passing, though no one checked her at the door. "Hey, you're black?" My father, who looked white, told me this story. Every year, when he'd go to get his driver's license, the man at the window filling out the form would ask, "White or black?" Pencil poised, without looking up. My father wouldn't pass, but he might use silence to trap a devil. When he didn't speak, the man would look up at my father's face. "What did he write?" My father quizzed me.
You know, if it isn't obvious, Daracot is a light-skinned black woman, and this is not the only poem that she's written about being light-skinned. I mean, she's actually written quite a few.
I mean, she mentions, you know, Larson's Passing, and that's, I think it's Nella Larson who wrote this Passing back, I think, in the late 1920s about two women that were passing as white, and it's a terrific story, and it has a very upsetting ending, which I won't give away.
I just looked it up. It's 1929. This is one of her themes, but it's really, you know, I find it, interesting to, not interesting, but rather like that negotiation of spaces. And like that happens in some ways with me, with my culture, right? Like, I don't look stereotypically what people, you know, I'm not Ricky Ricardo running around in like ruffle sleeve shirts and playing the congas. And then sometimes I purposely, like sometimes in, not purposely, but sometimes in Latino groups, I kind of won't speak Spanish. And I just mostly, I don't know, I just, it's just a really interesting psychological space where you're like, kind of can be and not be at the same time. And I love that she takes that up in so much of her work, right? Like, and which speaks to racism and speaks to prejudice in all sorts of ways from a perspective that is unique to her.
By the way, for listeners who are of the young variety saying, "Who the hell is Ricky Ricardo?" Ricky Ricardo was the husband on I Love Lucy with the brilliant Lucille Ball, sort of his foil.
Ricky and Lucy.
That's right.
But I think it's also, you know, it seems to me, and you're a gay guy, that people talk about LGBTQ stuff one way if they're in a group of gay people, differently than if they're with a group of straight people. White people talk about race differently in a group of white people, and black people talk about differently about race. You know what I mean? It's like that. Yeah. You're like an infiltrator, you know, and I think that's what she talks a lot about in this. As someone who assumes you're white.
In a way, it's like, and she hits sort of an insider view of that world. And so it's terribly complex. I mean, you're right. And it's also like, myself as a gay man, like, you know, sometimes you're in a cab or something and the cabbie says something ridiculous about some woman walking down the street. And I'm like, you know what? I don't feel like coming out today right now. I'm like, I'm not in the mood, you know? Like,
yeah.
And so you're kind of, you know, indirectly passing as heterosexual, right? So it's really interesting how that yeah, that's a really neat parallel too. So yeah.
Well, right. I thought I would love to read A Place in the Country. This is about real estate, because I think these issues about being black in real estate is, I mean, there's
timeless,
still true.
Unfortunately, right?
They're still true. I mean, you hear this all the time in 2023. So, read for us, Terry Dericotte's A Place in the Country.
I was actually trying to find out the date when this was written. It's copyrighted in 2017, but I imagine, I'm not sure if that's not necessarily when it was written, but yeah. And I'm thinking this could have been written yesterday too, right? Mm-hmm. A Place in the Country. We like the houses here. We circle the lake, turning into dark cleavages, dense, packed gleanings. We could live here, we say. We're smiling, but thinking of the houses at the last resort. The real estate agent looked surprised when she saw Bruce's face, then flipped quickly through the glossy pictures. I'm sure you won't like this one. I can tell it's not your kind. Our house in Essex Fells took a year to sell and sold to a black family. A friend explained, once a house is owned by black people, they're the only ones they'll show it to. Do we want to live someplace with a view overlooking the politics? When we pass an exit named Negro Mountain, Bruce smiles and jerks the wheel as if we almost missed our turn. Why must everything we want come by stealth? Why is every road in this bright country furnished with its history of hatred? Yet we keep smiling, driven by a desire beyond the logic of if we could afford it and whether we would love or hate it if we did buy. Again, this one is in the like Joan said, these simple lines that are so accessible, right? But then they're like the whole idea of that exit and wanting to turn off the sort of faking to turn off, like this is where we're supposed to belong. The idea of everything we want by stealth. And then that amazing line of someplace with a view line break overlooking the politics.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's also like, I can imagine, you know, and I'm not even going to compare my life to, you know, African-American or black Americans, but I often say, you know, like sometimes it's just, like being Cuban American is like a full-time job. Being gay, it's like a full-time job. And sometimes you just want that view without the politics, you know, you just want to live your life. And like, I love that she sort of pinpoints this so nicely. And, you know, it's this constant. And I imagine that's what women feel like too all the time, right? It's like, you're always, every time a woman, when a woman wears or doesn't wear, whether they put makeup on or don't put makeup on, whether they're wearing high heels or, you know, flats, it's always like a statement. It's always something about you. You're constantly sort of,
yeah.
And sometimes you just don't want to deal with it. You just want that view without the politics.
Hey, we're talking to Richard Blanco. Richard, when you mentioned at the beginning that you, when you were talking about Dericotte, and you said sort of a mentor, do you mean long distance, or she actually has been a close-up kind of mentor?
No, long distance, just because she was one of the people that was, well, she's still like a major American poet, but was really coming online back then. And someone we read a lot in graduate school.
Oh, she is great.
Yeah. And if we have time, I want to just close with a short poem by Lucille Clifton.
By whom?
So I just want to end by sharing this short poem by Lucille Clifton, which is so iconic for Black History Month. It's called, Won't You Celebrate With Me? Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
That's pretty great.
Wow.
That kind of wraps it up.
Something has tried to kill me and has failed. Wow. Yeah, tell us about Lucille Clifton.
Well, she's a contemporary of Toy Darcot. She passed, I believe, in 2010, I think. But
2010.
Very short lyrical poet. Just wonderful poems about the body. There's this one amazing poem about her hips. Mother of like three, Maryland. Just really just one of the icons of Black American poetry.
By the way, the name of that poem that you just mentioned is called "Homage to My Hips." So, I can't wait to read that.
Really getting into the
Homage to My Hips.
Hey, Richard, great to talk to you as always. Thank you so much.
Hey, same here.
Be well.
Thank you very much for those great choices, Richard. Yeah, you too. We've been speaking with Richard Blanco. He is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history, the first poet laureate of Miami-Dade County. His latest collection is How to Love a Country. And Richard himself is a great poet as well. Coming up,
indeed.
All Revved Up. We'll hear from the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III on what it means for Seattle to ban caste discrimination. We're also going to talk about the new controversy involving the comic strip Dilbert and a New York Times piece on the Kung Fu Nuns of Nepal. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, as we said to you a few times, will be at the library not just Tuesday and Friday this week, but Thursday as well for Ask the Governor. Joining us now on Zoom for another edition of All Revved Up on Boston Public Radio are Reverend Irene Monroe, syndicated religion columnist, and the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Emmett G. Price III is the founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Together they host GBH's All Revved Up podcast. Speaking of host, last time we saw you, Emmett, you were about to host last night's event for the Hamilton Garrett Center for Music and the Arts with Take Six and others. How was it?
It was the most amazing concert I have been to in so long. And even though I was on the stage and emceeing, Take Six blew the crowd away. Patrice Rushen blew the crowd away. But the headliners were the Hamilton Garrett Drumline and the youth choir. They were phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, those drummers really changed my day. They were fabulous at the library. Probably never allow them back in with the drums, but nevertheless, they were spectacular. It sounded like a great event. Congratulations.
So let's start with the controversy. Hundreds of newspapers across the country have dropped Dilbert after this racist tirade by the guy that creates it, Scott Adams, this weekend. Here's the sound of comments that got Dilbert in trouble from his video podcast, Real Coffee.
You know, nearly half of all blacks are not okay with white people, according to this poll. Not according to me. According to this poll, that's a hate group. That's a hate group, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. And I would say, you know, based on the current way things are going, the best advice I would give to white people is to get the hell away from black people.
The poll he's referring to is the Rasmussen poll. They're a conservative polling organization. But I wonder what your reaction to this is. Both of you, will start with you, Emmett.
Well, I mean, if he doesn't want to have anything to do with me, it's good riddance. You know, there's no loss of sleep on my end. And, you know, this is a classic case of not only gaslighting, but false narratives that spew and really don't allow for the complicated nature of a phrase. On the surface, that phrase could sound like it's something. The problem is that phrase has been used by white supremacist ideological groups for so many years that it's almost like the phrase that's used, you know, with Brandon's name in
that's
it, you
right.
know, whatever
that's
right. that phrase is. So to not allow that phrase to have the incendiary and oppressive meaning that it has, just, I mean, this is not even a conversation. This is insane.
No. Yeah, you know, what bothered me about it is that it's amazing because the strip has been going on since 1989, and I used to read it very much in the beginning because it's just quite funny. But I have noticed that once he became a very vocal Trump supporter,
yeah.
I began to see how he was really promoting not only segregation, but really pushing an extreme ideology. And although he says that the statement that he was repeating really comes from an online trolling campaign by an alt-right organization here. But I think that what bothers me about it is that then he says it, and I was very glad to get up this morning and read that the Boston Globe has also decided not to run his strip here. But I think that what bothered me also about it was that Elon used this moment as Elon Musk used this moment as an example to confirm bias under sort of a guise of being a free speech absolutist. And that really troubled me because he seems more concerned about free speech of people who make racist and homophobic and anti-Semitic statements. More so, he's more concerned about that than about the comment itself.
I think that's a given. By the way, I was just reading, as you were saying, well, the good news is all these newspapers, including the Globe, have dropped his column. The even better news, the Associated Press reports 20 minutes ago that the syndicate that distributed his column, his cartoon, has severed its relationship with him. You know, the downside, though, is you say the guy, be totally ostracized by decent people, but he's made his zillions of dollars. He's now a hero to the alt-right or whatever. So maybe he got exactly what he was looking for. You know what I mean? I'm not even sure this is punishment to have him canceled, not that I have an alternative.
I agree. But what we run against, because, again, one of the sort of tropes that they run is the sort of disparaging, quote, you know, woke culture. And I had wondered, could we have turned this moment into a teaching moment? Because it's such a large audience that he does reach, and he reaches progressives as well as you know, right wingers. So I just felt like giving his platform, his particular platform, could we have used this, you know, for a moment to sort of have a kind of needed conversation.
Well, I think the way that we're doing it is to actually make the obvious statement that it's okay to be white. In quotes, is coded language, which means something different. So no one, if the assumption is that black people don't think that white people should be white, however you define white and whiteness, that's not the point. The point is the phrase, as a literary phrase, that a population of black people who understand and know what the phrase is say that we do not agree or we don't condone, or we're not okay with the use of that phrase because we know symbolically and metaphorically what it signals.
What
I felt was is that I was very glad, number one, that you didn't have a torrent of black people saying this is crazy. But what I was hoping to get, but in many ways we see it by the virtue of a lot of newspapers moving away from him and stuff. I really wanted to hear from white folks saying that this is just absolutely absurd. Because I really felt that it is the silence around that and then the swift sort of cutting him off keeps this kind of animus bubbling under the surface.
But you don't want to know something. I don't know if I can articulate what I'm thinking, but I'll give it my best shot. Is as venal as, who's a good example, as David Duke, the former head of the Klan, is, he hasn't come into my house. And so I don't mean I forgive him for anything. It's not as personal. I hope I get this right. Dilbert, I like you, Irene, I used to read this a lot, not in the last couple of decades. I had no idea about the Trump connection, the MAGA thing that you mentioned. And so in some ways, I feel much more invaded. Do you know what I mean? Which I believe will cause more people who are silent in situations like this to do exactly what you're hoping, Irene and Emmett, which is say something because they you know what I mean? I mean, I hope I articulated that. I think you
but
know
you
what
know,
I mean.
But, the thing about Dilbert, I mean, it really did have a wide audience.
Oh, it's huge.
And I felt this, that because he has the capacity to speak I mean, his message was universal. Everybody kind of like, yeah, you're right on this.
Exactly
one.
Right.
Spot on.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to just tickle. I mean, I used to just always open to him. And so I felt like he still has that capacity. See, I'm not giving up on him. There, David Duke, I do. But I do think that he still has the capacity to still speak.
Boy, I sure as hell don't.
A huge audience.
What I thought was so upsetting about this story, you mentioned Irene Elon Musk, that he tweeted and then deleted about this whole situation with Dilbert. What exactly are they complaining about? Like, he didn't get that this was a problem. I know he's a free speech absolutist and all this, but he didn't get what the problem was.
Wait a second. Why do you both say he's a free speech absolutist? People who've criticized him on Twitter have been banned from Twitter since he took over.
He claims to be.
No, this is how he defines himself. And
correct, how he defines himself.
As well as Kanye on his site.
I guess the thing is, how long can people stay on Twitter with this guy running it? It just seems as though, I don't know, it's getting worse and worse.
Well, it is getting worse and worse. I mean, the challenge is that Twitter in itself has become a communal space. You know, it's like most institutions of higher learning. You go to the school because they have a phenomenal football team. They grow great parties. The food in the cafeteria is amazing. And then you ask, you know, the generic student, you know, who's the president of this joint? They're like, I don't know. The football team is great.
Yeah.
But ignorance, but I agree with you, Marjorie, that ignorance is not bliss, because the point is that we're actually fueling the kind of animus that we're trying to truncate. I think that if we're not educating while this stuff is circulating, then we're participating in it. We're allowing it to happen. I just feel that if people are going to do this, see, I'm about free speech. If you say it, and I feel that once you educate people about it, you can then hold them more accountable to it than just swiftly cutting them off.
We're talking to Emmett Price and Irene Monroe.
Okay, Jim told me he's very excited about this story. I'm not sure if he wants to be one of those, you know,
preppers.
Preppers that run off to the deep, dark, frozen forest of Idaho to wait for the apocalypse. But anyway, apparently, a lot of so-called Christian patriots are doing exactly that, leaving blue states and going to Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and stuff like that. And they call themselves, some of them, do call themselves Christian nationalists. So,
I mean, it's sort of a variation on what Scott Adams said. You know, stay away from them. What these people are doing is staying away from non-Christian nationalists, and so let's move to a community that's all ours.
Well, they let the Orthodox Jews and the Messianic Jews in too, Jim.
I saw that. I did read that. Well, I'm not an Orthodox Jew, so I won't be going to Northern Iowa, Idaho anytime soon.
But I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they're doing out there, but it sounds kind of scary to me.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. There is conversation of plans for secession.
Yeah.
There's conversations of plans for, these are areas where the price of real estate is lower than other areas, right? So somebody was telling me a couple weeks ago about things like this without any kind of data. I mean, this article in the Washington Post has some data in it, but they were saying that the places where you can afford to buy, you know, in New England, they call them camps, or a property, are increasingly in red states.
That's right.
Yeah, because the blue states are the ones where the real estate prices are so high and heavy, you can't even get in. So,
but it's not just that, Emmett, though.
Well, I'm just saying that
because the point is that if it was that appealing, a lot of us in blue states that can't afford housing would move there. But it's the history. The country, if you've ever been, I've been out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. If you're ever going to Yellowstone Park, if you've ever been out to that part of the country, I swear to you, it is just absolutely beautiful. But historically, we got to understand here that has historically, the Northwest has always been that space, and that sort of what they're now trying to call it, an ethnic state where white supremacists would gather. They actually had at one point promoted what was called a Northwest Territorial Imperative. One of the reasons why the state of Oregon joined the Union was under the condition that you didn't allow blacks to enter. So that has always been a place where survivalists, isolationists, even some people who say they're environmentalists, but certainly a lot of conspiracists go out there and they can do paramilitary training. It's nothing new, but I thought what was very hubris was, but I shouldn't be, when you think about Marjorie Taylor Greene, she called for a national divorce. And I'm thinking between liberals and conservative states, and I'm thinking, oh, didn't we have a civil war that we kind of addressed this issue? But I'm not
Well,
surprised.
She also swore to uphold the Constitution when she was sworn right. in, which apparently she doesn't get. Emmett, you were mid-thought. What were you about to, what was the end of what you were going to say there?
Well, I think I'm in agreement with Irene. I think the point is, with the vision of this kind of white supremacist nation state algorithm, it all makes sense where you can actually relocate and actually move towards that vision. But let's also make the plain statement that these are the areas that actually were highly saturated by indigenous people as well.
Right.
So and that an becomes increase. Another. Yeah,
That's
an
right.
increase.
And the,
yes.
And the increase, and the also thing about it is that, and there's been data that between 2010 and 2020, there has been an increase of AAPI, Black people, you know, so, and of people of other religious faith as well. But this territory, it's very, very interesting because it's nothing new. It has always had that kind of, this is the sort of, you know, building ground. This is the sort of, you know, military platform where we can have the kind of ethnic state that we've always tried to have since
you know,
the beginning
I was thinking of
this country.
Of buying a small place in northern Idaho. Now I'm definitely not going to do that. By the way, I'm looking
but
at
a
the
lot
text.
Of Blacks have bought it, but a lot of but the thing is that Kanye West, I know he doesn't matter in some sense, but he's out in Wyoming. What is it? The guy down in Atlanta, Tyler Perry, a number of Blacks have bought real estate. As a matter of fact, in Idaho, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it could be Oregon, Mega Evers' widow lives out there. So you do have people out there. And when you
I don't think they're in these communities in northern Idaho where this is going on. They may be
well,
in the Northwest.
She's in northern you know, Oregon. But yeah.
Can I get, we have a couple of texts like this. How is it that Dilbert was published in yesterday's Boston Sunday Globe? The answer, I didn't know the answer. I was listening
answer.
To NPR this morning, our station, actually.
To get the comics
printed weeks
in
advance.
Yeah.
Dan Kennedy said that on the morning news. It's, right. So it's going to appear there for a little while. By the way, the next person, since we talked about your concert last night, said in capital letters, please, please, please ask Emmett about the amazing concert Gumbo New Orleans he organized at Berkeley last week. Is that another one of your deals?
We did a Black History Month. The celebration at the institution was on Thursday. It was collaborative for a number of our departments, and that was another amazing event.
You were amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Busy guy. Busy guy. So,
but it ends though. Tomorrow's the last.
Listen to
him.
Listen to her.
So we'll be
available 24/7 as of
so
Wednesday.
I need to say this. So high Black Employment Month for us. Tom
is over.
Abrupt end. Tomorrow at midnight.
Feast or famine, right? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, God.
Ross, is it Dufas?
I don't know how to pronounce
his name.
He's
a columnist for the New York Times. I think he's a Catholic. He's a religious guy in any case. He's got this argument in the Sunday Times saying you can't predict the future of religion, basically arguing that organized faith could fall apart tomorrow, but someone would have some spiritual or mystical encounter that would resurrect religion soon enough. It basically is arguing that there are many people of strong faith who have lost faith in organized religion, which seems like fairly obvious to me. But Emmett, go ahead. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think many of us are just trying to get it right versus, you know, this sense of, you know, here's the only way to do it. And here's, you know, the one way to manifest whatever. I think that's why, you know, some of us as scholars go back and try to read the sacred writings again and again and again. I mean, you know, Irene often talks about the hermeneutic of suspicion. When you avail spaces for, you know, suspicion in your readings, your readings change. You know, we as human beings change. So I mean, yeah, there's always going to be a reformation. Yeah. There's always going to be a flip and a change, you know.
And an ebb and a flow. And an ebb and a flow, mm-hmm. depending upon not only tradition, but how what becomes front and center. When tradition and mysticism and tradition becomes front and center. Then stuff like the political events and social events that gives credence to that becomes the sort of main way in which we talk about religion. But what happens is that when you see generations of people like, you know, what we call the nuns, not the Kung Fu nuns, but the N-O-N-E-S nuns here,
oh.
shape, you know, what happens when they begin to have more voice around debunking mystical traditions as well as what we call conventional tradition, it changes. But you know, the real thing about religion, I just want to say this about religion. The real thing about religion here, it bothers me why it becomes so front and center. It should be about a period of discernment and help us to live in the questions that we ask about human nature. It's nothing definitive.
Why do you say mysticism? I think mysticism is hidden under the rocks for the most part, because if you talk about being a mystic, everybody thinks you're a nut. So why do you
Absolutely.
Say it's, why do you say mysticism is front and center?
Well, it depends, because mysticism should be front and center. But when we think about mysticism, and particularly when we're talking about Christianity, it doesn't, largely because a lot of women like Joan the Arc and others have been profound shapers of mysticism, and they give what Emmett and I were talking about, a hermeneutic of suspicion about not only how we read text but how we live it out. And can I just segue to this? The Kung Fu nuns are a good example of that. That are changing Buddhism.
Yeah, they're the ones that are doing a lot of
physical, bringing a
kung
kind
fu,
of mystic,
gender
right.
equality,
around gender equality,
and
that kind of stuff. We're almost out of time
go
ahead.
You know, I was just going to ask if this podcast, what's the status?
We did the one Black History Month podcast last, I think it was last week that we dropped it, a week before. And so we're on hiatus planning for season 6, which will launch probably sometime next month,
Mom,
I think, probably the end of the month or so.
And the reason why we're on hiatus.
Yeah, all right. We know why.
We are fatigued.
It's been a busy month. It's been
That's
a busy
right.
month. It's been
That's
a busy
right.
month. Okay, you guys, thank you very, very
Hope
much.
Hope you sleep
always.
In, Irene, on Wednesday. That's all I'm
most
hoping
definitely
for
will.
You.
Thank you.
I knew you would.
You. Okay, we've been speaking with the Reverend Irene Monroe, syndicated religion columnist and the Boston Voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, Emmett G. Price III, founding pastor of Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Austin, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music, where I guess he put on the great Gumbo New Orleans event just the other night. And as you say, Jim, he was down with us at the Boston Public Library.
How great were those drumline kids, though?
They were great.
Were they
I mean,
spectacular?
They were so talented. And I love the little kid
I
that
knew
the drum
did.
Was bigger than he was.
He
you
was
know?
Great.
The drum went from his knees to his neck, you know, but he's banging away.
Really
and he was
great,
really,
great
Amari,
music.
I think his name was.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway,
too.
Together they host GBH's All Revved Up podcast, which is a really interesting podcast. I think you'll enjoy it. Coming up, the phone and text lines are open. Do you find it rude to make a phone call? This is a theory that's gaining more and more credence in 2023. Is it rude to call somebody up? Do you need to ask texting permission before you call? Or you like Jim and never talk to anybody, but you just text them? That number to call if you want to weigh in on the texting versus actually speaking to somebody, whether you're on one side or the other, 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the library tomorrow. We're there Friday as well, as we always are. We're also there this Thursday, which is unusual because the governor will be with us. Thursday, Ask the Governor live at the Boston Public Library. You know, we talked at the top of the show today about smartphone use and teens. We're going to close the show with a related concept sparked by an advice column in the Washington Post. I think it was Miss Manners.
Miss Manners,
is it true?
It was, yeah.
Is it true that people now think it's rude if you call them on the phone? I can answer that. The answer is yes. That you're only supposed to text. I can answer that too. That is correct. The person looking for advice wants to, quote, spread the word that it's not rude to use a phone to make phone calls. I completely disagree. Why would anyone want to make a phone call out of the blue when you could just send a two-second text message? We have both sides covered here, Marjorie and me. 877-301-8970. You can call us or even text us at this number. Do you agree with the concept that it's rude and aggressive? I would say in a waste of time to call someone on the phone. Or do you like the immediacy and the one-and-done nature of a quick phone check-in? I don't know if you read this piece in the Washington Post a few months ago by Ellen McCarthy. Mm-hmm. She said, impromptu calls have become roughly equivalent to turning up unannounced at someone's home and smashing your face up against their window. I couldn't have said it better myself. I don't do that, ever.
Well, I don't know why this causes so much anxiety, which apparently it does, because you see the number that's calling. If you don't want to talk to them, you just don't answer the phone.
Marjorie, every time I call you, what do I do before I call you? Every time.
That's not true, Jim.
Oh, yes, it is. Well, Are you callable is what I say my text.
That's usually when you're calling me at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
Okay, so or 7 o'clock on a Saturday night. I say, are you call? You know, beyond this, the rude part of it, and by the way, Miss Manners says in her thing, what's her name again? What's the real name?
Judith
Martin, right. Yeah.
Judith Martin.
She says not only is it rude in the age of the cell phone, she thought it was rude even pre-cell phone when there was no texting. You just don't call somebody unannounced or impromptu.
Well, hold on. She thought telephone calls were rude prior to the answering machine because if the phone rang, you kind of had to answer.
Yeah.
You didn't know who it was.
Yeah.
It might be some really important thing. So it was intrusive and it required immediate attention unless you were just not going to pick up the phone.
Now, let me explain something. The beauty of the text message is you just write it. You don't have to listen to the response, sometime which is endless and not on point. If you get a response to your text, then you can respond to that if you choose. Once you engage verbally on a phone call, you are trapped. You are there for the duration. And I'm serious. And I have some people in mind. And as a result, it's more efficient. It's more economical. And you're not intruding upon. You know what it is like? It is like running up to someone's house and smashing their face up against your window.
Okay, let me say this and then we'll get to the phone calls. In defense of the phone call, I think misunderstandings are less likely in a phone call. The tone or
that part
what,
is
you
true.
What yeah. you intended. Right. And sometimes you get, you know, these text messages from people that go on for like 3 inches of text because they're trying to, you spend more time answering the text or responding to the text than you would if you called them back and explained the situation.
That's a rarity.
Texting
That's
can
rarity.
Be very time-consuming.
Okay, well, fine. Marjorie's pro-call. I am anti-call.
Well, I guess I'm a little concerned that we've got become such little snowflakes that calls make us anxious. What
Did
are you laughing
at? Jamie,
at?
Our lead producer, said, concerning Jim's method, you know, the text first and whatever, it's the worst of both worlds. He not only texts you, but then he calls you. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. That is maybe a downside of my method.
I think it might be fair to say you don't want people to call you, Jim.
That is correct.
But you can call them.
Can I tell you something?
Uh-huh.
I would say, and by the way, I'm just trying to teach people a lesson.
Yeah.
I would say of every 50 phone calls I get, I take one. And the answer is, you know why? Because if someone really needs you, you know what they do? They text you. And when you read their text, which, by the way, doesn't need to interrupt your life, you may say, I'm too busy right now, or I'm taking a nap, or I don't want to talk to anybody right now. So you don't even look at the text until you feel good about it.
Okay,
that's
Jim.
The bottom line.
David from Lexington. Thank
Hello,
you for
David
calling.
From Lexington.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to talk to you, too.
Yeah, what's up, David?
I you know, if someone wants a real conversation phone, if it's just like, you know, I'm on the way to meet someone and they
text.
Get stuck in traffic, a text is fine. But I don't want to have a conversation in text.
We got it. David, thank you for the call. He obviously has rules in his life, and I think that's fine.
Well, I think those are sensible rules. You don't want to have a conversation in Texas. It's for a quick little nugget, Jim. That's
little
what
nugget.
For. Little nugget.
Well,
exactly.
When do you need more than a nugget? I mean, seriously.
Well,
give me an
well,
example.
Well, I will say this, Jim. The shortest phone calls I've had in my whole life are the ones I have with you. I mean, they are
and do you
over
not treasure that?
45 seconds.
Do you not treasure
well,
that?
Yeah, because you know how there are people that you know if they call – you're going to be on the phone for like 45
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, I do know one.
Then there are people that are – it's not me, Jim, anymore. I've learned. I've been cut off, but in 45 seconds I've learned, gotten the message. But then there are people that you know are going to be short phone callers like you. I have some friends like that. So you're not worried about taking the call because you know it'll be quick and to the
Marjorie,
point. Yes,
who
Jim?
Leaves the longest voicemails in the history
I
of the world?
I haven't left you voicemails
ever.
For 10 years.
You and you have to listen
this.
To all 4 minutes
move
of
on,
it.
Jim.
Because you may know mm-hmm. there may be something yeah. of value.
Okay. You're stuck back. You're back in the aughts, Jim. Back in the aughts.
Melissa in Cambridge, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about text communication versus talking to someone on the phone. Hi, Melissa.
Yeah, hi. I have to come down. First of all, good to talk to you all
too.
Again.
You too.
I have to come down on Marjorie's side on this one.
Thank you,
sure.
Melissa.
Yeah.
And it's quite ironic, I have to say, Jim, that you would start off with such consternation about this, you know, study about social media and its impact on people and the fact that they're not relating and talking to each other and instead they're looking down at their devices. And
exactly.
then we come to the end of the That's show, and you don't want to talk to anyone.
Well, Melissa, can I make a suggestion to you? Don't listen to the beginning and the end of the show on the same day.
There's a thread here, and I just want to say I'm one of those people that people text me or email me and say, "Can I set up a time to talk?" I say, "Just call me."
Wow.
And if I'm available, I'll pick up the phone. If not, I'll know that you called, and I'll call you back.
Exactly.
Well, that is a grown-up woman.
Melissa,
it's great to talk to you as always.
Your support.
Thank you.
Very mature. Very mature. Okay, here's a good point, though, from Patrick and Quincy on the other side. Why would I want to stay on hold for an hour with you guys when I can just send a quick text and be done with it? And that is an excellent point.
By the way,
we
you're not on hold for an hour. We move through the calls pretty
you're not,
quickly.
But I think he's making a point there.
He is.
Texts are very quick. You see them. You see them right away, so that is a good point. Al on the road. What do you think, Al?
What's up, Al?
Hey, guys. Jeez, I've been on hold for like an hour now.
Okay, nice try. Go ahead.
Okay.
I read years ago in the Miss Manners article that the telephone was the rudest invention in the history of man.
Right.
I don't think that's changed much, but texting has seemed to have tempered it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I take phone calls from my mother and my wife, and that's about it.
Wow.
And I'd prefer a text from those two as well.
That's a good one, okay. Al. Thanks for the call. 877-301-89. So what are you laughing at?
Phone calls were rude before smartphones. Really? What were we supposed to do? Send a letter telling the recipient we're going to call them and provide a date and time. Give
point.
Me a break, says Gene. From New Hampshire.
By the way, it's Miss Manners who said they were rude even before the cell phone. But that texter makes a wonderful point.
Right. But then she tempered her opinion when the answering machines came along. Yeah. Because you could just not answer the phone and they could leave you a message.
By the way, when we use the term answering machine, for young listeners, they may not even know what an answering machine is. You bought a little box. You went to like whatever the predecessor to Best Buy was. You buy a little box for like $69.99.
Yep.
You plug it into your phone. And had a little tape in it, and it did what your voicemail on your phone service
that's right.
does, your wireless service does now.
That's excellent explanation,
Well,
Jim.
Thank you. I think I did quite well with that.
Kate from New
Hampshire. I'd rather text that explanation, frankly. But Kate from New Hampshire, hi. Welcome.
Hi. I think as far as, like, you want to hear people's voices. So if you have a time limit, you can say, do you have time for a 3 and 3? You get 3 minutes, I get 3 minutes,
wow.
or a 5 and 5. So you can put a time limit on it, and you get to hear somebody's voice. So
wow, another
that's my feedback.
I like the 3 and 3 thing. That's actually pretty clever. I like that. Kate, thank you.
You know, as Kate points out, that hearing somebody's voice is important, according to these studies, that they worry about people connecting with each other and our anxiety and depression. I mean, to me, the idea that phone calls causes anxiety is just really, I don't know what's happened to us here. We can't even take that. But that the voice is a big deal, the actual communication, as opposed to just reading what somebody says.
Don't you feel like they're breaking? It's like breaking into your house. It is like breaking into your house. Oh, you call someone unannounced. It is so intrusive. It is unbelievable.
Jim, you don't have to answer the call.
Well, you don't have to talk to the person who broke into your house either, but he's in your house. He's in your house. They're in your house. They're in your brain spot or whatever it is.
They're Bill in from your brain spot?
Well, okay. I can't think of the right words. Bill from Chelmsford texts, may I have permission to call you and discuss this? Is now good? The answer, to quote a great cartoonist at The New Yorker, is how's never is never good for you, Bill. That's what I would say to that, but thank you for asking.
Here's a good one from Donovan Hollister.
Bob Mankoff, is that his name? What was the name of that
Bob
brilliant?
Bob Mankoff, I think.
We had him on the show once. Remember how excited we were?
Oh, God. Well, he's such a great cartoonist.
Donovan
from Hollister wants to know, why do people answer just to say they don't have time to talk?
That's a very good point.
Just let it go to voicemail. That's a very good point. Brad in Porter Square. Hi, Brad.
Hello, Brad.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Fine, thanks.
So I definitely believe in the phone call because I constantly get trapped in text conversations where it's
exactly
paragraph after paragraph. And I work in sales, and I know that it's you get so much more done, and it's so much more effective than making a phone call, make an appointment, clear it all up, and then you're good to go.
But Brad, if you're a salesperson, you know you have to be respectful. I assume we should all be respectful of your potential clients. What happens when they won't shut up? What do you do about that? I'm serious.
You've got to listen. As a salesperson, you've got to listen and you've got to take it all in.
Oh, my God.
You know, because that's the whole point. You can uncover little golden nuggets.
Oh, well, that's actually an interesting point. Brad, thank you for your call. You're probably pretty good at what you do.
Very good. Well, I think if you're in sales, it definitely helps to be able to talk to somebody, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I assume contact is a positive thing.
Your
but maybe they don't want to talk to you either. Maybe they just
that.
Want the product or the service. And you move on, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, but well, you know what I'm trying to say? Maybe I didn't say this.
You're antisocial. You don't make eye contact.
Let me put it another way.
You don't want to talk to anybody.
Let me put it another way. No, maybe all those things are true. It is. You have more control of a communication if you're texting than
don't.
You're calling on the phone.
No, you don't.
Yes, you do.
You have a lot of opportunity for misunderstanding and intonation and what someone's voice says to you than if someone texts things. I mean, how many times have people misunderstood your intention in a text?
Often.
Like a lot of times.
Often, yes.
You know what else, Jim?
No.
If you're doing anything that matters in a text,
one
thing we've learned from Donald Trump.
What's that?
Best not to leave a trail.
That's a very good point.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with me. Yes, I do know what you're saying.
Jennifer from Franklin, thank you.
Hey, Jennifer.
For calling.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller and love hearing you guys. Have been listening for years.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm a psychiatric child and adolescent psychiatric nurse practitioner.
Wow.
Oh, God, glad you called.
Just to kind of reiterate on a lot of stuff you guys have been bringing up, that there's so much misunderstanding with text, and people don't learn how to have a conversation and go back and forth and have a disagreement because everything is scripted. Jim, you were saying you have more control, and you do. So you can make sure that everything you're
saying
is
right. That's a wonderful
point,
I'm embarrassed to say. You're right about that, Jennifer.
Jennifer.
So kids don't know how to do that, and that's telephone calls are a great way for them to practice that and reduce their social anxiety.
So, Jennifer, I've heard this so many times from friends with teenagers that people break up with each other in text messages.
It's horrible. They break up with each other, like you said, the misunderstandings, and then they save it. So they'll take a screenshot of what people have texted and show it to all their friends.
That's a good point.
So that makes it even worse, because before, if you had an argument on the phone, then it's done. Maybe your friend will tell somebody. But they're not screenshotting it, and everything you regret saying is now permanent.
Oh, that's a good point, too. That's
I hate
a good
to say this,
too.
Jennifer, but that was a fabulous call. We're glad
Jennifer, before you leave, Jennifer, we talked at the beginning of the show about the impact of smartphones on kids' mental health, the hours they're spending. Some studies say up to 8 hours a day, and whether kids should have their phones in bed with them in their bedroom at night and other electronics. Right. What do you see in terms of the impact of cell phones on kids?
Just what you said. It's terrible. It's terrible on their self-esteem. It's terrible on their attention. It's terrible on social communication. But I have a hard time with my own kids limiting stuff. So
Hey, Jennifer.
I don't let them bring it up to bed till they're in high school.
Call us again. You're great. That was really great.
Okay,
thank you. Judith from Framingham sent this text. She says, clearly don't list Jim Browdy as your emergency contact.
Exactly.
That's a pretty good one.
Exactly.
That's actually quite funny.
Oh, here's another good one. I sometimes wonder what my son's voices even sound like. He always one son. He never answers his phone. I hear that a lot from parents. Their kids never answer the phone. They text them all the time.
So do you answer? If you you answer your phone all the time, unless you're like in a swimming pool or something.
Well, it depends on who's calling. I mean, you get all these calls from people trying to sell you things.
Tell me the last person who you didn't take a call from. I don't believe this. Who called you?
From anybody whose number I don't recognize.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, do you take calls from numbers you don't recognize?
I don't take calls from anybody I do recognize.
You don't take calls from anybody. But I'm sure you answer when your children call you.
I do. Yes, I do.
Okay, well, there you go.
I do. And as soon as they got in line, I said, child, do not call me again. I told you that. Text me if you need me. It's your father speaking.
Okay.
Michael in Virginia, what's your deal?
Okay, I got a good connection.
Good.
It's a corollary to the previous caller.
Yeah.
People who call you back just to tell you they don't have time to talk.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like some... Because why are you calling? If you, I totally disagree with everything you said this whole show. I'm totally on Marjorie's side for this.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michael.
My cell phone is a home phone. I put it in the same place. Just like when I was a kid growing up and we had the Bell, like, green phone and all that crap and no answering machines. And my sister was on the phone for 3 hours every day. I just treat it like a home phone. And there's certain times of the day that I look at it, and sometimes I don't. I mean, I do play a lot of chess lately, so I guess I'm sort of addicted. But this is not actually that hard.
Well, right? I hear you. I mean, you're another one who's thought through this and made a considered decision, which I admire. I just disagree with the decision. But, Michael, you're another one on Marjorie's side. Thank you for the call, as always. We appreciate it.
A lot of people are on my side here, Jim. I'm reading the text.
So here's what an anonymous texter said. Why don't you read that, Marjorie? Do you have it on your screen from somebody?
If it's on Comrex, I don't.
Oh, sorry. It says, wild that the man who talks on the radio for 3 hours a day finds it intrusive to answer a three-minute phone call. That, unfortunately, is a good point.
Yeah, and who wants people to call? We want people to call us on the phone, don't we?
No, in all fairness. No.
What?
Don't put words in my mouth. Okay. My attitude, I've told you this since the day we started working together, whatever calls we get on the radio are for you. That's the way it's...
okay.
And if I choose to participate in your conversation with somebody... I will.
Well, we're very grateful, for example, that Sabrina has called us from her car.
We are,
because
actually.
You cannot have a talk show if no one wants
to
talk to you.
That's a good point.
Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, Sabrina.
Hi. Oh, my God. I just wanted to say I've been dreaming of this moment for, like, 6 months. I love you guys. I love listening to you guys.
Thank you.
Part of the reason why I love listening to you guys is because you guys are so sarcastic. And being sarcastic is obviously, like, a very... I guess, playful and, like, entertaining part of a conversation that's hard to, I guess, get across when you are talking over text. And especially you guys, like, Jim and Marjorie, when you guys are texting each other, I mean, I guess you don't text each other because of you're saying that you're having all these troubles talking to each other. But it's just, I think it would be hard to get across your sarcasm.
Exactly. That's a very good point.
Sabrina,
it's very difficult to do texting with a lot of nuance or a lot
But hold on. How many times have you misinterpreted something I text? I text you probably 20 times a day. How many of the 20? No, I'm serious. Well, that's not a lot. How many times have you misunderstood whatever the text is?
20 times a day is a lot, Jim.
Well, no, it's not. Not when you work with someone.
Okay.
Hey,
okay.
Sabrina, so what was it like waiting this 6 months till the moment occurred?
I'm literally shaking right now.
Hey, Sabrina.
Rena, you are fabulous.
Call again.
Thank
that
you
was
for
a great
your call.
Call.
We really appreciate it.
Here's Paul in Fort Lauderdale. In the words of my grandmother, Marjorie, short phone calls from Jim are a blessing. Don't question it.
I don't think that's a compliment, actually. But thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Why are you giving the number? We only have a few minutes left. I don't know.
Okay. Helen in Mansfield. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Helen.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Another
thank
one. We
you
love
very
that.
Much.
Thank you. What's up?
I agree with Marjorie. Oh.
Thank you.
I had an instance where my grandson had an aneurysm.
Oh.
And I took him to the hospital, and you know, all my grandkids are all on their cell phones, and I couldn't remember his birthday. So I called each and every one of them, and nobody answered their cell phones. And finally, the nurse came out and said, let me text them. So she said, because we can't admit him into the hospital, and he had to be med-flighted into Boston.
Oh, God.
And a nurse came out, and she texted, and they finally texted back, and
well,
they admitted him.
Helen,
so
it is true that
people answers their cell phones.
Yeah, they don't answer their cell phones. That's why you do
Helen's
it in text.
Helen's painting me in a corner, too.
Well, that in an
that
important situation,
one,
right?
Thanks.
You get a response really quickly, especially in an emergency if you text rather than
good point, Helen.
Rather than call. Millennial here, I have phone friends and text friends. Certain friends like to chat. That's how we catch up. Others, we text occasionally to check in. It's weird when my texting friends call me up. And that's a very good point. You do have people in your life that are texters and people in your life that are phone call people. And you know, it's tough to get my kids to pick up the phone, too. I must admit, their mother calling. They have nothing to say to me, Jim.
Well, but do you have a problem with your relationship with them? No. You're texting and you're fine. Everything's good, right?
Everything is
good. As far
good.
As you know.
Everything is good as far as I know.
Okay,
that's
fine.
Right.
Okay, that's good.
Here is, this person didn't sign. I just finished a 40-minute phone call with my brother in Michigan that left us both feeling happy and connected with all that happiness research showing it's our social relationships that mean the most. Why would we get rid of phone calls?
Well, that's what that study that we talked to Arthur Brooks about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so, apparently we're very lonely, Jim, in the social media days. Between
you know the British government, you know, has like a secretary or something of loneliness or some such thing.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people are isolated and they're living by themselves or they're living with people that can't stand.
You know, I just realized, by the way, one of the most important things that I should have said, and this it's the loneliness or isolation that made me think of it. How many phone calls can you have at the same time?
Well, if you can be on the conference call.
Well, no, with different people about different things. How many phone calls can you be on at the same time?
I think just one, right?
One. How many text discussions can you be on at the same time?
Lots of text discussions.
Unlimited. So
yeah,
if you're
right.
concerned about social isolation, the ability to surround yourself with a large number of people rather than just one is far greater with the text margin.
Yeah, more opportunity to misunderstand and screw things up, Jim. That's what I would say.
I asked you what was the last time you missed something you misunderstood. Oh, when I fooled you on April Fool's last year, I humiliated you. That's
you
true.
You did. I fooled you for 20 years, and then you got me, and it was, you know what?
It was one of the most satisfying days
I'm
of my
over
life.
April Fool's. I'm telling you
Well, you're
right
over it because you lost last year.
Well,
that's
I'm
why.
Over it because it's coming up soon, and I don't want to go through these elaborate machinations.
Well, I haven't made that deal, so we'll see what happens.
Okay, well, whatever you say or text on that day, I'll know that I'm not going to talk to you about
it. So we're done, unfortunately.
We're done.
Thank you. We really appreciate your calls.
I want to say we're not only going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow, but we're also going to be there Thursday and Friday. Maura Healey, the new governor of the Commonwealth, is going to be with us for Ask the Governor on Thursday and come down and see her.
Filed a huge tax cut package today, by the way. Yeah.
You can talk to her in person. Or you can text her or phone in, and we would try to get to as many texts and phone calls as we can because we keep the phone calls short. That's so that we get a lot of people in. Anyway, we talked to the top. Oh, I'm on the wrong page. We're done. Okay, tomorrow at the Boston Public Library.
Coming up is not us.
Is going to be NBC Sports Boston's Trina Casey, the NAACP's Michael Curry, GBH's Sam Turkin with his latest story in the newsroom, the Priced Out series. That has been a great series.
Great series.
It is so upsetting about how nobody can afford to buy anything around here unless you're like a zillionaire.
Or to rent anything.
Or to rent anything, exactly. We'll speak with the Globe's, with the GBH's rather, Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen and CNN's John King about the latest out of D.C. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss. Our executive engineer is John the Claw Parker. Brian Bell is on the boards for us today. Our executive producer is Jamie Bologna. Anything you might have to say before we go, Jim?
No, I'll text you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
She missed it, of course. When Marjorie's doing something else, it's like Forget about it. I'll explain that later.
Okay, so we're done. Thank you very much.
We're really done.
I hope you can tune in tomorrow. If you want to come to the library, you don't need any tickets, no reservations.
Does it cost anything? I can't remember.
It doesn't cost anything. It's free.
Can you stay as long or as little as you want?
Stay as long as little as you want.
Wow,
yep,
that's good
to hear. They got a Newsfeed Cafe. They can have a cup of coffee. You can have something to eat, some pastry, a sandwich, whatever you want.
Exactly.
And we'll be there from 11 to 2. Thank you very much, Jim, for showing up. You did a nice job.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that coming from you.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you can tune in tomorrow or stop by the library. Meanwhile, have a great afternoon.